Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. till midnight Eastern Time. If you're listening live over a radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. And our access code is 449389#. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is in the Gospel of John, chapter 15. So let's see, Gospel of John, chapter 15. Gospel of John, chapter 15. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. If a man abideth not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that ye bear much fruit. So shall ye be my disciples. As the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you. Continue ye in my love. If ye keep my commandments, ye shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments, and abide in his love. These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you, and that your joy might be full. This is my commandment, that ye love one another, as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if ye do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what your Lord doeth. But I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you, that ye should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you, that ye love one another. That was the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verses 1 through 17. Okay, tonight's topic we're going to focus in on, I haven't been here for the last couple of weeks. I know Gerard's been running things, and well, actually 2 weeks ago we just had some problems and we just never, you know, went through the normal process of the way we start with looking at some subject matter. And last week Gerard was taken over from me. I know we were planning on doing jury nullification, and so tonight we're going to do jury nullification. Before we read this and take a look at this, it is a memorandum that we wrote concerning jury nullification. We've got about 20 memorandums done. If anybody is interested in following through with the reading of this memorandum, go to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, and click on Action Against the Judiciary, and you'll see a list of memorandums of law, and the one we're reading is on jury nullification. Now, I think we got about, I don't know, 18 or 20 memorandums up here right now. We got about three or four more that should be going up very shortly, and we're working on maybe another half dozen. I'm not sure exactly how many we're going to be writing. The purpose for writing these memorandums is really focusing in on specific problems or specific, topics, okay, concerning the common law or concerning, the equity. Either we're in equity or in law, and in law or at law means natural law. Sometimes you'll hear that the titles are referred to as law, but they're really statutes or codes. They really should be identified as statutes or codes or regulations. And of course, those are in equity courts. Anytime you have statutes, you're in an equity court. When you're in a court without statutes and you have a jury, you're in a then you're in a natural law court. But we're looking at a lot of topics, and some of the topics, we've done a couple of these already, and we'll be doing, like I said, tonight, the jury nullification. But you can look down the list, and you could see we did one on civil versus natural rights. There is a difference between civil rights and natural rights. You know, civil rights particularly, you know, is statutory. That's what the focus is. But bear in mind, we did codify our rights, at least 10 of our rights we codified. But we have many, many, many rights that have not been codified. The rights that we've codified would be found, of course, in the Bill of Rights. You know, we also did a memorandum on USC Title 18, which is where the penal code is found. Again, there's a lot of subjects here. We did a court of record, Article 3 courts, Amendment 13, the true Amendment 13, the 10th Amendment, the 2nd Amendment, acts of treason, high treason, jury nullification, jury tampering and stacking, law and equity, difference between, nonjudicial foreclosures, sovereignty, statutes, codes, and regulations, tax courts, and again, there's quite a few more that should be coming up. The purpose of writing all these, and again, people could use these memorandums in their own cases if they want. They just need to write them with the proper court name and proper information, whoever is filing the court case. But anyway, it proves the point of whatever the subject matter might be. So the memorandums of law, they're undeniable. They're self-evident. They're not moot. They cannot be argued. They are facts. And, of course, each one of them end with a conclusion. And each one of these conclusions, you know, we will bringing into our case against the judiciary. We will, you know, we've been looking at this and talking about this for a while, preparing for the judiciary case. We're going to be, going and filing suit against the judiciary, the federal judiciary. Back and forth in the beginning, thinking about the United States Supreme Court. We're kind of hoping to do this without really labeling them as part of the lawsuit. At least that was the original thinking. But as we write these things and put this together and start to put a case together to see how and who is liable for all this, we have to go to the boss. We have to go to the top. And so therefore we have to really sue the United States Supreme Court. I don't know if anybody's ever done that before, but there's always a first time. And we're going to be doing things in a very unique way, which we're not going to talk about those details until we actually make the filing. But it's going to be in a very, very unique way. Each one of these memorandums covers a topic. The abuse of the courts the certain things that the courts ignore. Again, they've hidden our courts, our natural law courts. You can't find the door. You can't even find a window to climb in. The only courts available are equity courts or I guess you'd call it a quasi-equity. Let me think on what I would call this. Well, look, at a court of record requires a jury control, period. No judges allowed, no judge opinions, no judge statements, just a magistrate. All judges are magistrates, by the way, so they can fill the position of a magistrate inside of a courtroom that is a court of record. But a court of record is one that is tried by jury. And even the judge is not to even bring up anything in any way concerning his decisions or ideas or anything, how he interprets the law or anything. As a matter of fact, he should be, the magistrate should be notifying the jury at the beginning of a case, the knowledge of jury nullification, and explaining that to them. But of course they don't. I'm sure there's probably, I don't know, maybe there are some judges who might bring that up, but I'm not aware of anything. But I know there was a time when they did. And so we as the administrators bringing in, you know, juries within our own counties, and those are the positions that we the people need to take up, that's how we consent to our government. We consent to what's going on as far as in our courts are concerned through the jury. Okay, so it's we the people that make the decision. We the people decide whether we want to indict or not. We the people decide whether there's guilt or innocence. We the people decide, you know, how do we restore the individual, which the courts for many, many years, at least my lifetime, haven't even looked at that idea of restoration. You know, they're keen on finding and taking away, you know, maybe seizing the property of someone, their vehicle or a house maybe or something, whatever it is that they own, okay, if it had any way to play in with the crime. But the injured party doesn't seem to see any of that. It goes to the state. The fines goes to the state also. The people don't get to see that. So the injured party is really just kind of kicked out of the court at the, you know, after they're through with them. They don't need you no more. They just throw you away. Meanwhile, there's a lot of money to be made by incarcerating an individual. You know, they go to prison. There's money to be made. Again, the fines, as I mentioned, and maybe seizing the properties and so on. So the whole system is upside down. And then if you go into a court where is maybe focused on for instance, statutes. Let's take the penal code in U.S. USC, let's see, was it 18, Title 18. So in Title 18 is the penal code, and, you know, if they bring codes up into the court and they operate under the rules, which would be Title 28, which is the rules of all of the courts, the equity courts, rules and procedures, hang on a second. All right. Anyway, these rules and procedures that they follow is not the way natural law courts are to run. And again, the judges really are only to be there as the administrator of the court. They're not to persuade the jury one way or another. They're not to make any decisions. Matter of fact, they are there just to certify the decision of the jury, to put the seal and the signature on whatever the determination is by the jury. And the case is a court of record. Now, a court of record cannot be appealed. You cannot appeal from a court of record. You know, we see a lot of cases where people appeal their cases, and I don't even know why they even try to entertain them. Maybe they entertain them because it's a kind of a quasi-fictional statutory process. I mean, I don't know. It's really a foreign court, bottom line. It's not even a proper court of equity. I mean, how can you have a jury that's controlled by a judge in an equity court that can be appealed? I mean, the whole thing is, it's just really very strange, and if you really understand how the process is supposed to work, and very strange the way they've got this. But again, we've been robbed. We've been robbed of our courts of law. So that, of course, is the purpose of our lawsuit. And we have to go after the United States Supreme Court because they are the responsible ones. They are the chief. You know, they're the top. They are the ones that are supposed to be correcting the problems or anything taken place down on the lower courts. But again, the way they've set things up and they've hidden, they've concealed. That's a crime. Concealing the natural law courts that should be open to us is a crime. There are no paperwork available in any state court that I'm aware of. I know here in New York, and no paperwork available for sure on the federal level that permits you to get into anything other than civil. They have what's called civil and criminal. And the United States Supreme Court has made this point clear, and as you look into it and research it, it becomes pretty obvious that any civil court or any criminal court, either one of those two, okay, are not courts of record. Matter of fact, they're equity courts. In natural law courts, there's no such thing as a civil court or a criminal court. It may be a case that's going, it's a criminal case, or it could be a case that really is maybe a contract case of some kind, or someone suing someone for damage for some reason or another. But they're not referred to as, well, this is where civil cases are heard, and this is where criminal cases are heard, and this is how this one operates, and this is one how that one operates. No, it's just one court, and whatever the case may be, as far as the purpose of the court, the lawsuit in itself. It's extremely important that we, the people, understand these things. And I want people to take this to heart and really understand this point. You cannot have liberty if you don't understand it. You cannot have liberty if you don't know what you have liberty from. Free people say they're free, they got freedom and this, that, and the other thing, we are really incarcerated in statutes, incarcerated in codes locally, and also on a federal level. And of course, that's a major problem. And the reason they get away with this, and the reason why the courts are the way they are, and the reason why the courts are, the natural law courts have been hidden, concealed, and you can't find them, you're not even aware that they, people aren't even aware that they exist. It's because we're ignorant. If we don't know these things, then, we don't know them. You can't fix them. You can't identify them. You can't see them. And then people wonder why courts, end up with the conclusions that they end up with. And people are abused. How does all this happen? It's because we're ignorant. So anyway, that's the purpose of our course. Now, it is really to get rid of that ignorance. And again, our course is covering pretty much everything a person needs to know to be a patriot and understand the law of the land, understand the founding documents, the three founding documents, which is the law of the land, understanding the common law process and procedure, to understand these things. And it doesn't take a brain surgeon to come to an understanding of these things. Our children should know this before they even get out of school. They should know this in grammar school, but they don't, and we don't. I heard something, commentator or news broadcaster or whatever they are, who knows, made a comment concerning an individual who was not an American citizen who was claiming a right. And they said, was this person crazy? They're not a citizen of the United States. They can't claim these rights. They have no clue on what natural law is then. Our rights are unalienable. You don't have them because you're American. You don't have them because we have the Constitution. You have them because you have a beating heart and blood pumping through your veins, and you're created in the image and likeness of God, and you have every right to these unalienable rights. Now, of course, God does not bless many of us with that. As a matter of fact, I think America has been cursed for quite a few years, and that's why we've suffered the losses of our unalienable rights. And we don't even know what half of them are. We don't understand the reasoning on why our voting for a president is the way it is. Most people don't anyway. They don't understand the process of that. A lot of people want to change it because they think popular vote should be there, but they don't understand why we have the system we set up. It's not the people that elect the president. It is the states that elect the presidents. But each state gives to the people the vote to make the decision for that state on which way they're going to go, as far as the president is concerned. It's extremely important that the president, is elected by the states. You know, people don't understand, why do we even bother have senators anymore? The states are no longer sovereign. They're not sovereign because they have no vote. They have no say. 17th Amendment did away with that. Why did that happen? How did that happen? Because we're ignorant. We're ignorant to the law. We're ignorant to our founding documents. We don't understand them. You know, we the people are slaves. We've been enslaved by the state. In two different ways, we've been enslaved. We're in a statutory prison. We're governed by codes. Don't do this and don't do that. We're fined to death, taxed on everything. And then they tax your sweat, your labor. That's the 16th Amendment. Constitution is crystal clear. There is to be no income tax. Crystal clear. It is not moot. It is the facts. It's self-evident. And our founding documents make it absolutely crystal clear. And, people buy homes and that's their property, and then they scratch their head when they lose them to tax foreclosures. How can you lose your home because you didn't pay your taxes? Well, you don't own it. The state owns it. How did they get away with that? It's because we're ignorant. And, we start off our program every night, and one of the every Monday, once a week, and one of the things or one of the points we make is to support what we're doing here and that the proceeds go to NLA's effort to save America. The only way America is going to be saved is if the people become educated, the people get rid of their ignorance. They come to a knowledge and an understanding of what the common law is and what our founding documents are. If we don't know these things, then we can't have freedom. Jefferson was clear. If a people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Can't happen. Impossibility. You can think you're free, but you'll be beat up everywhere. You'll be taxed to death, right into enslavement, okay? And we'll be controlled on everything we do, walking down the streets, driving a car, putting up a fence to 1 foot too high. I mean, all these, it just goes on and on and on, and you think you're free. No, we're not free. We have been incarcerated in many different ways. Our freedoms have been blocked in many different ways, and people don't know it. You know, God says, my people perish for lack of knowledge. And lack of knowledge, and he's talking about lack of knowledge, of course, of God particularly, but he's also talking about the law. And the law of the Bible extends right into the law of the land, right into our Constitution, right into our Bill of Rights, right into our Declaration of Independence, right into our courtrooms, the process, the procedures, the way things are set up, the choosing of 12 individuals, the 12 witnesses, just like the apostles, 12 witnesses. That's what they were. The Bible refers to them as the witnesses, 12 of them. And that's how our court system is set up. We have 12 witnesses. You put 12 individuals focusing in on and with 12 different points of view, with 12 different minds, and they studying a problem, a situation, to see what is the right thing to do. And I think you can pray if they're untainted and uncontrolled by laws of men, by words of men, by judges, by prosecutors, if they're uncontrolled, in the case of prosecutors, I mean particularly with the grand jury, they get their ham sandwich. That should be an insult. Why aren't the people insulted by that? People should realize how not free they are just by that statement. When a prosecutor says, I can indict a ham sandwich. I don't remember the name of that individual recently that was indicted. I think it was in Chicago. Some actor or singer or something, I don't know. And then the prosecutor, the grand jury indicted. They indicted the man. How can a prosecutor overshadow an indictment and decide, we'll forget about it. We're not going to we're not going to, you know, come in and bring a court case and find this person innocent or guilty. We're just going to let him go because the prosecutor decides to make that happen. They don't have the power or the authority. People don't know that. They're ignorant. There are lots of cases, and we've seen it. People, you know, that belong to National Liberty Alliance come in with problems and situations. We hear lots of stories of people going into the courts and, you know, where the charges, the grand jury, you know, comes in with, you know, A, B, C, D, you know, a whole bunch of different things, and they have to now go to court. And as time goes on, the charges may drop on this and that, and they'll add a different charge here. And before you know it, they're defending themselves on something totally different than what they were indicted for. How do they get away with that? How does that happen? It's because the people are ignorant. We're ignorant. If we knew these things, we wouldn't let them get away with it. You know, we're ignorant to the committee man process, the political controls. You know, we the people have government by consent. We the people can and should have 100%, not 99, not 99.9, 100% control of our government. Well, how do you do that? You know, the elected individuals, you know, those people we've elected and the people that they've appointed, they'll tell you, well, you get to choose and you get to have government by consent at the ballot box. That's it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, and, you know, the ballot box is not going to give you control over our government. We have to have control over our courts, 100% control over our courts. And we get that through the grand jury and a trial jury. When we have a true grand jury and a true trial jury that is not tainted in any way, that is not governed or controlled by any prosecutor or by any judge, you know, how do we control our political process? We do that through the committee men. People don't even understand. And the people who do know about the committee men, they're not even elected. They think they're elected, but they're not. These people have taken total control over our political process. It's either the thief or criminal on the right or the thief or criminal on the left. You get to choose. Now you see, you get to choose now. Now you have government by consent. This criminal or that criminal. Doesn't matter. They don't care who gets elected, a Republican or Democrat. They've got total control over both parties. More over one, it seems, these days than others, and because we're breaking away from this. And, yeah, Trump's doing a great job, and things are really heating up and getting ready to bring us to much closer to freedom and getting rid of the deep state, a lot of the criminal activities and stuff. But Trump cannot save America. He can put us back on track. He can work with others and break down the deep state and the Justice Department can come up and bring up all these indictments and we can put these people in jail. We can hang them. Do whatever the law permits or requires. But that's not going to give us a free nation. That's not going to give us liberty, only for a little while, maybe. If our courts are not controlled by the people, if our political process is not controlled by the people, we cannot have liberty. We cannot have freedom. We're only going to lose it soon. Why? Because we are ignorant. I speak to myself first, but I am ignorant no more. And everyone should say that. Everyone should study and know these things. And again, you know, it's not a burden. It's not boring. It's not something you read and put you to sleep. It's exciting. You know, true law is really exciting. The way our nation was built, the law of the land, which, of course, is the three founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, okay? Fascinating document. And as you look into the conversations by looking into the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, reading the decisions of the United States Supreme Court, and there have been very, very, very many great decisions by them, defining the meaning of terms, of the words and the phrases that we use, and so on. But, of course, the enemy's in there. We have a couple of socialists in the Supreme Court, and we should not tolerate them. We the people, nobody even in government knows that they can get rid of these socialists. Judges get to serve only during good behavior. What does that mean? Well, it's very simple. It means that if they're not obedient to the Constitution, they're not in good behavior. They're in bad behavior, and we can remove them, and that includes the United States Supreme Court justices. Now, it's the job of the of Congress to get rid of these people that are in bad behavior, okay? But they don't seem to do it. And if they don't do it, we the people can do it, but the people don't know. We the people, if we take control, and everyone should become a committee man at least once in their lifetime, doesn't matter when, but at least one time in your lifetime, be a committee man. It's a two-year term thing, only requires your really most of your time during the election process time, and it's not a lot. If it's 40, 50 hours a year, it's a lot, okay? And it's exciting because you get to sit down and interview these people that want to run for office. Why do they want to run for office? Are you statesmen or are you politicians? What are you? Do you know the Constitution? What's the Second Amendment? What's the Fifth Amendment? What's the Fourth Amendment? What's the Tenth Amendment? What do they know? You know, what do they know about the law? What is equity? And what is law? What's the difference between the two? You know, all these things, these are simple things. They're not difficult. We just need to apply some time and understand them. We don't have to be articulate in what we learn. We don't have to be able to go out and teach it. We don't have to really remember terms or this or that. We just need to understand it. Okay? And some people need to really come to a better, be able to articulate it. You know, if you want to become an administrator, you should be studying at a level to be able to articulate these things. And so we need to, the purpose of the administrators, of four administrators in every county is what we're looking to put. And those four people would be responsible for orientating the juries, the grand juries and the trial juries. It would be a full-time job, paid position. And right now people are being paid to do that. But these people are all political animals. They maintain the status quo. They like their ham sandwiches. You know, these people that control this process, okay? We, the people, should be controlling it. Why have we given it over to the fox? We've given the hen house over to the fox. We need to take control of this. So anyway, everybody that's in this room today and anybody listening to this particular broadcast or any of our broadcasts, but anybody listening to this broadcast on MP3, you know, during the week or whatever, they need to respond and get educated. They need to take the course, Government by Consent. And a lot of people need to consider, if you're looking for a good job, to consider becoming an administrator within your county, which means, again, you know, you administer to the grand juries, the trial juries. You orientate them. You give them advice. You research things and questions they might ask you to do. You make, in the case of grand juries, you make available for them to be able to look deep into any case, to be able to go, you know, if they want to investigate something, we make sure that the pathway is open that they can do that. If they want to go down to the county building and find out what's going on and look into their computers and into their desk drawers and quiz the people down there, that's their right. We're the boss. We have every right to go down and see what's going on at the workplace. We're the owners of this country. But it's not the way it's running. It's, you know, the people are not in control. It is the political animals that are in control. They're maintaining the status quo. They're destroying us in the courts. They're taking our homes, our children, and our parents' hard work and labor of what they've built that they want to give to their children, and they take it away. It's unbelievable what's going on in the courts today. And they get away with it. Why? Because we, the people, are ignorant. The people expect to be ignorant and free. Forget about it. So anyway, everybody should be taking that course. Everybody should be considering becoming an administrator. And if, of course, maybe you have a good job or you're in business for yourself or whatever the case may be and you're not interested in that job, that's fine. Still should become educated. And you still should get behind us during this time and help push us towards the process. We're living in a time that is very potential there's a great potential of being able to be successful in what we're looking to do. We here at National Liberty Alliance have been working on this for over 8 years. I'd have to sit down and think. I think it was 2012 or 2013 when we went this route to deal with the juries, the grand jury and the trial jury and so on. We need to take control, and that's how we do it, by taking control, first of all, of having the knowledge and being able to do this. But anyway, we have to control what goes on in the court. We have to control what goes on politically. And if we don't do that, then we can't have liberty. And liberty, you know, it's a biblical principle, is freedom from the law. That's what it is, freedom from the law. You know, in a biblical sense, you're free from the law because, you know, when you become born again and you come to understand these things, you have a love for the law. So for, in that sense, you're free from its penalties, and you're free, and if you do fall, you know, you can repent and be found right back to where you should be as far as your relationship with God is concerned. But it's the same thing here with the law of the land, okay? We are sovereign. If we're sovereign, the sovereign makes the law. That's what the meaning of sovereignty is. The sovereign makes the law. And how did we, the people, make the law? We did it by making a constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declarations of Independence. We've laid out the procedures and processes of the laws that are required to run this nation, and you'll find them in U.S. titles. And so there are 56 titles, I believe it's 56, and all those titles are the law, is statutes, codes, and so on, regulations, and it controls different things, commercial activities, controls the government, the different agencies. Every agency has regulations, you'll find them in the titles. They're under the control of the law that we've permitted Congress to write. Again, statutes and codes and regulations, and they have to obey them. But the people don't obey those things. They're not written for us. Congress has never been given power to write penal codes. We have natural law courts. We've never given the United States Supreme Court the decision to change laws or make laws. They, too, seem to abuse their powers. They've legalized murder. Roe versus Wade. They trampled upon God's domain, his place, which is natural law. Those decisions belong in natural law courts. They don't belong in the equity courts. And again, they've created the equity courts, and they call them courts of record, and they use statutes, and they control the whole process, and they get away with it because we're ignorant. So we need to get rid of this ignorance, and we need to do that by taking this course and studying the book. We're writing a book at the same time, and that should come out not long after the course is finally completed. But you know, the book, I think that I can say that anybody who comes to an understanding of the contents of the book, and it's going to be political and judicial, but everything you really need to know as an American, as a free person, as a sovereign, will be in that book. I don't think we're going to miss anything. We've been working at all of the different subjects in hand. Going back to this, these memorandums we're writing, which each one is a lesson on its own, and it has a focus and a conclusion. And each one of these situations and violations of these particular issues by the federal courts and the state courts, you know, are going to be addressed in our lawsuit. And the lawsuit in itself, the actual paper, and also all of these memorandums will become part of the course also. People need to read through these things to understand the meaning of these terms. And, you know, you understand the meaning of the terms, that's the key. You got the building blocks of understanding natural law. You got the building blocks to understand the process and procedures of how the court works. What's the difference between equity and law? And, you know, you can go into the into the law dictionaries. I don't know about the newer ones, but you know, we got Blacks and we got Bouvier's, those two particularly. You can go in there and look up law and look up statutes. And if you very carefully research it, you will find that equity is never called law. It is referred to as what's called positive law. Okay, positive law is human-made law. That's what positive law is. So, you know, you'll see the difference of that. But, you know, when we wrote the Constitution and we gave the jurisdiction to the federal courts, we gave the jurisdiction into law and equity. Law, in law or at law, is common law. And equity is statutes. So, you know, we gave them that. That's the jurisdiction we gave them. And yet the people don't understand it. They don't know. They're in equity courts all day long. They're being judged by political animals who are there for the sole purpose, ultimately, a lot of them anyway, because of our ignorance. They're there to maintain the status quo because there's a lot of money in it for them to maintain the status quo. There's a money flow for these judges, for these all these political individuals. How is it that everybody that goes into Congress or any becomes a, you know, an elected individual pretty much anywhere, and even to the point of appointed, how is it that they all become millionaires? All of them. They're all millionaires. How does that happen? You know, they don't get a salary that gives them that kind of money to be able to be a millionaire, and yet they all are. All right, anyway, we're going to go tonight, and we're going to look at jury nullification, and then we'll pick it up from there. So let's start off. Memorandum of Law on Jury Nullification. The purpose of this memorandum is to clarify for the court that the people, being the author and source of law, have the unalienable right as jurists to judge the law as well as the facts in controversy, to exercise its prerogative of nullification, sentencing, and to disregard instructions of the judge. It is the jury that is the final arbiter of all things and not the judge. This is government by consent. Any judge who forces his will upon the jury would be guilty of jury tampering. It would be an absurdity for jurors to be required to accept the judge's view of the law against their own opinion, judgment, and conscience. Since natural law was thought to be accessible to the ordinary man, the theory invited each juror to inquire for himself whether a particular rule of law was cognizant with principles of higher law. The people are the author and source of law. Sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists and acts. And the law is the definition and limitation of power. Sovereignty means that the degree of the sovereign makes the law. The foreign courts cannot condemn influences persuading sovereign to make the decree. The people of this state, as the successors of its former sovereign, are entitled to all rights which formerly belonged to the king by his prerogative, and the state cannot diminish the rights of the people. Supreme sovereignty is in the people, and no authority can, on any pretense whatsoever, be exercised over the citizens of this state, but such as is or shall be derived from and granted by the people of this state. We the people ordained and established the Constitution for the United States of America. We the people vested Congress with statute-making powers. We the people defined and limited that power of statute-making. We the people limited law-making powers to ourselves alone. We the people did not vest the judiciary with lawmaking powers. We the people are the judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising, functioning independently of the person of the magistrate designed generally to hold it, and proceedings according to the course of natural law. The Constitution of most of our states assert that all power is inherent in the people, that they may exercise it by themselves in all cases to which they think themselves competent, as in electing their functionaries, executive and legislative, and deciding by a jury of themselves both facts and law in all judiciary cases in which any fact is involved. The jury decides law and facts. The trial of all crimes shall be by jury. A trial is the judicial examination in accordance with the law of the land of a cause, either civil or criminal, of the issues between the parties, whether of law or fact, before a court that has jurisdiction over it. For purpose of determining such issue, it includes all proceedings from time when issue is joined, or more usually when parties are called to try their case in court, to the time of its final determination. And in its strict definition, the word trial in criminal procedure means the proceeding in open court after the pleadings are finished and the prosecution is otherwise ready, down to and including the rendition of the verdict. John Jay said, "The jury has a right to judge both the law as well as the facts in controversy." Samuel Chase, "The jury has the right to determine both the law and the facts." Oliver Wendell Holmes, "The jury has the power to bring a verdict in the teeth of both law and fact." Kentucky Resolutions, a series of resolutions drawn up by Jefferson and adopted by the legislature of Kentucky in 1799. Protesting against the alien and sedition laws, declaring their illegality, announcing the strict constitutional constructionalist theory of the federal government, and declaring nullification to be the rightful remedy. New York Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, "And the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts." Marbury versus Madison, "All laws, rules, and practices which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void." Miranda v. Arizona, "Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them." Jury's responsibility is to deliver justice, not uphold the law. The pages of history shine on instances of the jury as at jury's exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge. Jury nullification by Dr. Julian Heinlein. Jury nullification was introduced into America in 1735 in the trial of John Peter Zenger, printer of the New York Weekly Journal. Zenger repeatedly attacked Governor William Cosby of New York in his journal. This was a violation of the seditious libel law, which forbidded criticism of the king or his appointed officers. The attacks became sufficient to bring Zenger to his trial. He clearly was guilty of breaking the law, which held that true statements could be libelous. However, Zenger's lawyer, Andrew Hamilton, addressed himself to the jury, arguing that the court's law was outmoded. Hamilton contended that falsehood was the principal thing that makes a libel. It took the jury only a few minutes to nullify the law and declare Zenger not guilty. Ever since, the truth has been defense in libel cases. Several state constitutions, including Georgia's Constitution in 1777 and the Pennsylvania Constitution in 1790, specifically provided that the jury shall be judge of law as well as facts. In Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Justice James Wilson noted in his Philadelphia Law Lectures of 1790 that when a difference in settlement takes place between the judge and the jury with regard to a point of law, the jury must do their duty and their whole duty. They must decide the law as well as the facts. In 1879, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court noted that the power of the jury to be judge of the law in criminal cases is one of the most valuable securities guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. John Jay, the first Chief Judge of the U.S. Supreme Court, stated in 1789, The jury has the right to judge both the law as well as the facts in controversy. Samuel Chase, U.S. Supreme Court Justice and signer of the Declaration of Independence, said in 1796, "The jury has the right to determine both the law and the facts." U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1902, "The jury has the power to bring in a verdict in the teeth of both law and facts." Harlan F. Stone, the 12th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, stated in 1941, "The law itself is on trial, quite as much as the cause which is to be decided." In a 1972 decision, U.S. versus Daugherty, the court said, "The pages of history shine on instances of the jury exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge." Likewise, the U.S. Supreme Court in Duncan versus Louisiana implicitly endorsed the policies behind nullification when it stated, "If the defendant preferred the common sense judgment of the jury to the more tutored but less sympathetic reaction of a single judge, he was to have it." In recent times, the courts have tried to erode the nullification powers of jurors. Particularly impetuous for this was given by the fact that all white jurors in a southern state refused to convict whites of crimes against blacks. As a result, there is a practice of judges to incorrectly instruct the jury that the judge determines the law and that the jury is limited to determining the facts. Such an instruction defeats the purpose of the jury, which is to protect the defendant from the tyranny of the state. The purpose of the jury is to protect the defendant from the tyranny of the law. The problem with the all-white juries that refused to convict whites that committed crimes against blacks was not in jury nullification, but in jury selection. The jury was not representative of the community and would not provide a fair and impartial trial. In recent years, jury nullification has played a role in the trials of Mayor Marion Barry of Washington, D.C. for drug use, Oliver North for his role in the Iran-Contra affair, and Bernard Goetz for his assault in the New York City subway. In Les Miserables, Victor Hugo highlighted the differences between justice and law. The jury's responsibility is to deliver justice, not to uphold the law. Judges in Maryland and Indiana are required by law to inform the jury of its right to nullification. Article 23 of the Maryland Bill of Rights states, "In the trial of all criminal cases, the jury shall be the judge of law as well as the facts, except that the court may pass upon the sufficiency of the evidence to sustain a conviction." Nullification applies just as much in other states, including Pennsylvania. Article 1 of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania states in Section 6, "Trial by jury shall be as heretofore, and the right thereof remain inviolate." Section 25 states, "To guard against transgressions of the high powers which we have delegated, we declare that everything in this article is accepted out of the general powers of the government, and shall forever remain inviolate." Taken together, these two sections mean that jurors shall have the power that they had heretofore, i.e., when the Constitution was adopted. Judges usually do not inform the jury of this right. Even worse, some judges instruct the jury that it does not have the right to interpret or nullify the law, but only to determine the facts. Near the end of the alcohol prohibitions, juries refused to convict for alcohol violations. Nullification was never moot. It is useful to distinguish between the jury's right to decide questions of law and its power to do so. The jury's power to decide the law in returning a general verdict is indisputable. The debate of the 19th century revolved around the question of whether the jury had legal and moral right to decide questions of law. Underlying the conception of the jury as the bulwark against the unjust use of governmental powers, where the distrust of legal experts and a faith in ability of the common people. Upon this faith rested the prevailing political philosophy of the Constitution framing era, that popular control over the participation in government should be maximized. Thus, John Adams stated that the common people should have as complete a control, as decisive a negative in every judgment of a court of judicature, as they have through the legislature in other decisions of government. Since natural law was thought to be accessible to the ordinary man, the theory invites each juror to inquire for himself whether a particular rule of law was consistent with principles of higher law. This view is reflected in John Adams' statement that it would be an absurdity for jurors to be required to accept the judge's view of the law against their own opinion, judgment, and conscience. During the first third of the 19th century, judges frequently charged jurors that they were the judges of the law as well as the facts, and were not bound by the judge's instructions. A charge that the jury had the right to consider the law had a at the level of trial procedure. Counsel had the right to argue the law, its interpretation, and its validity to the jury. Nullification, the unalienable right of the people, this is government by consent. The pages of history shine on instances of the jury's exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge. It is presumed that the juries are the best judges of facts. It is, on the other hand, presumed that the courts are the best judges of the law. But still, both objects are within your power of decision. You have a right to take upon yourself to judge both and to determine the law as well as the facts in controversy. Thomas Jefferson. I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man, by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution. John Adams. It's not only the juror's right, but his duty in that case to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgments, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. John Jay. The jury has the right to judge both the laws as well as the facts in controversy. Alexander Hamilton. Juries should acquit even against judges' instructions. If exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong. Samuel Chase. The jury has the right to determine both the law and the facts. Justice Thurgood Marshall. Illegal and unconstitutional jury selection procedures cast doubt on the integrity of the whole judicial process. They create the appearance of bias in the decision of individual cases, and they increase the risk of actual bias as well. Chief Justice Matthew. It was impossible any matter of law could come in question till the matter of fact was settled and stated and agreed by the jury, and of such matter of fact they, the jury, were the only competent judges. Sir John Vaughan. Without a fact agreed, it is impossible for a judge or any other to know the law relating to the fact, nor to direct a verdict concerning it. Hence it follows that the judge can never direct what the law is in any matter controverted. Lysander Spooner. The bond set to the power of the government by the trial by jury, as will hereafter be shown, are these: that the government shall never touch the property, person, or natural or civil rights of any individual against his consent, except for the purpose of bringing them before a jury for trial, unless in pursuance and execution of a judgment or decree rendered by a jury in each individual case, upon such evidence and such law as are satisfactory to their own understanding and consciences, irrespective of all legislation of the government. John Adams. It is not only his right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. William Crushler. Unless the jury can exercise its community conscience role, our judicial system will have become so inflexible that the effect may well be progressive radicalization of protest into the channels that will threaten the very continuance of the system itself. To put it another way, the jury is the safety valve that must exist if this society is to be able to accommodate its own internal stresses and strains. If the community is to sit in the jury box, its decisions cannot be legally limited to a conscienceless application of fact to law. Lysander Spooner. For more than 600 years, that is, since Magna Carta in 1215, there has been no clearer principle of England or American constitutional law than that in criminal cases, it is not only the right and the duty of the juries to judge what are the facts, what is the law, and what was the moral intent of the accused, but that it is also their right and their primary and paramount duty to judge of the justice of the law, and to hold all laws invalid that are in their opinion unjust or oppressive, and all persons guiltless in violating or resisting the execution of such laws. Alexander Hamilton. That in a criminal cases, nevertheless, the courts are the constitutional advisers of the jury in matter of law, who may compromise their conscience by lightly or rashly disregarding that advice, but may still more compromise their conscience by following it. If exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong. Alan Shiffen, John Van Dyke. When a jury acquits a defendant, even though he or she clearly appears to be guilty, the acquittal conveys significant information about the community's attitude and provides a guideline for future prosecutorial discretion in the enforcement of the laws. Because of the high acquittal rate in prohibition cases during the 1920s and early 30s, prohibition laws could not be enforced. The repeal of these laws is traceable to the refusal of the juries to convict those accused of alcoholic traffic. Clarence Darrow. Why not reenact the code of Blackstone's day? Why, the judges were all for it, every one of them. And the only way we get rid of those laws was because juries were too humane to obey the courts. Oregon Constitution. The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Indiana Constitution. In all criminal cases whatsoever, the jury shall have the right to determine the laws and the facts. New York Constitution. The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Constitution of Maryland. In trial of all criminal cases, the jury shall be the judges of law as well as the facts. Hansen v. U.S. Within 6 years after the Constitution was established, the right of the jury upon the general issue to determine the law as well as the facts in controversy was unhesitatingly and unqualifiedly affirmed by this court in the first of the very few trials by jury ever had at its bar under the original jurisdiction conferred upon it by the Constitution. Mozzetti v. the United States. But jurors are not bound by what seems inescapable logic to judges. U.S. v. Thatcher. Judicial and prosecutorial misconduct still occur when Congress is not yet an infallible body incapable of making tyrannical laws. U.S. v. Wilson. In criminal cases, a jury is entitled to acquit the defendant because it has no sympathy for the government's position. Jury tampering. Thomas Jefferson. To consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which places us under despotism of an oligarchy. Theophilus Parsons, if a jury accepts as the law that which the judge states, then the juror has accepted the exercise of absolute authority of a government employee and has surrendered a power and the right that once was the citizen's safeguard of liberty. For the saddest epitaph which can be carved in memory of a vanished liberty is that it was lost because its possessors failed to stretch forth a saving hand while yet there was time. C.J. O'Connell versus R. Every jury in the land is tampered with and falsely instructed by the judge when it is told it must take or accept as the law that which has been given to them, or that they must bring in a certain verdict, or that they can decide only the facts of the case. Taylor versus Louisiana. The purpose of a jury is to guard against the exercise of arbitrary power, to make available the common sense judgments of the community as a hedge against the overzealous or mistaken prosecutor, and its preference to the professional or perhaps overconditioned or biased response of a judge. U.S. versus Thatcher. A defendant's right to inform the jury of the information essential to prevent oppression by the government is clearly of constitutional magnitude. Unalienable right of the jury in sentencing. There is no statutory prescription against making the jury aware of possible punishment. Instead, courts have disallowed jury awareness of sentencing. Contingencies have preemptorily resorted to the fact-finding, sentencing dichotomy to justify this denial. For example, the Eighth Circuit in United States v. Goodface merely stated that the penalty to be imposed upon a defendant is not a matter for the jury, and so it was proper not to inform the jury of a mandatory minimum term. No further justification is given. In making this factile distinction, the courts have created an artificial and poorly constructed fence around the jury's role. The Supreme Court has not mandated that jurors be in the dark on the issue of sentence. Those courts so ruling have done so on unconvincing grounds. The power of jury nullification historically has extended to sentencing decisions, and it rightfully should extend to such decisions. Proper instructions to the jury. Instructions to the jurors in criminal cases in Maryland. Members of the jury, this is a criminal case, and under the Constitution and the laws of the state of Maryland, in a criminal case, the jury are the judges of the law as well as the facts in the case. So that whatever I tell you about the law, while it is intended to be helpful to you in reaching a just and proper verdict in the case, it is not binding upon you as members of the jury, and you may accept or reject it, and you may apply the law as you apprehend it to be in the case. United States v. Molan. If the jury feels the law is unjust, we recognize the undisputable power of the jury to acquit, even if its verdict is contrary to the law as given by a judge and contrary to the evidence. If the jury feels that the law under which the defendant is accused is unjust, or that exigent circumstances justify the actions of the accused, or for any reason which appeals to their logic or passion, the jury has the power to acquit, and the courts must abide by that decision. Alan Shefflin and John Van Dyke in jury nullification. The arguments for opposing the nullification instructions are, in our view, deficient because they fail to weigh the political advantages gained by not lying to the jury. What impact will this deception have on jurors? Who felt coerced into their verdict by the judge's instructions, and who learned, after trial, what they could have voted their conscience and acquitted? Such a juror is less apt to respect the legal system. Jury decision is final. This is government by consent. Justice Kent said, "The true criterion of a legal power is its capacity to produce a definite effect, liable neither to censor nor review. And the verdict of not guilty in a criminal case is, in every respect, absolutely final. The jury are not liable to punishment, nor the verdict to control. No attain lies, nor can a new trial be awarded. The exercise of this power in the jury has been sanctioned and upheld in constant activity from the earliest ages." H.G. Wells, "The jury is the Achilles heel of tyrants." United States Supreme Court, "The decisions of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal. The decisions of an inferior court are subject to collateral attack." In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. Decisions of a court of record, that is a trial by jury, may not be appealed. It is a binding on all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be appellate or the Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgments of a court of record. And again, a court of record is a trial by jury. The judgment of a court of record, whose jurisdiction is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. We the people are the most qualified to make and decide law because we are the authors of the law, and we vested Congress with statute-making powers that we the people in our courts of justice reserve the right to consent or deny by nullification according to the facts of the case as we see fit. Furthermore, as a nation, we called upon our Creator in our founding documents to be the king of our courts of justice and not man, whereas we read, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve its political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impels them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Declaration of Independence. Preamble, the United States Constitution. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And by His grace and holy will, we the people, in 1789, were gifted with His liberty to be what man was meant to be, free and independent. A consequence of this prerogative is the legal ubiquity of the King. His Majesty, in the eye of the law, is always present in all his courts, though he cannot personally distribute justice. His judges, we the people, as jury both grand and petit, are the mirror by which the King's image is reflected." Since then, 1789, we have been engaged in a battle against the rulers of darkness over the control of our courts as the final days of Leviathan draws nigh. We the people sit on the King's bench and are able to reflect His holy will as we read in His word. "This shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law into their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people." God, Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 33. "This is the covenant that I will make with them After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my laws into their hearts, and into their minds will I write them. Hebrews 10:16. Therefore, to permit the servant to rule the master is absurd, and as recent years have proven, the control of our courts by bar members throughout the last quarter of the 20th century has brought we the people under the rule of despotism, of an oligarchy, as Jefferson had warned. We the people of the king's bench, being the jury, being the source and arbiter of the law, have a duty and an unalienable right to judge and decide in all things, which includes sentencing, with an eye on restitution, as the tribunal of all lawful courts. To deny our unalienable right of consent in these things is to war against we the people. Thereby, our word is final. Sealed and dated, signed, Grand Jury Foreman. Okay, that was memorandum on jury nullification, and the contents of that memorandum makes it clear jury nullification is not moot. It is also self-evident, the information that we put together into that memorandum. So it is, you know, jury nullification is self-evident. And it's time that we the people take control of our courts. And we will not have just courts until we do that. And again, we can't do this if we're ignorant. And again, you know, even if you're not going to be an administrator and not take a position in any way to try to push this forward, of course you need to be with us to help push this into the courts and get this out. But nevertheless, you know, the people have got to make these decisions, and they have to have the knowledge to do it. We cannot be free if we are ignorant. We just cannot do it. It's not possible. So again, everybody needs to be taking these courses, particularly the government by consent course, and also once we get the book out, which will cover everything plus more, and everything you really need to know to have government by consent will be in this book, which again will follow the completion of this course. Okay, let's see where we're going to go from here. Do we have any questions, Jen?
We have questions, yes.
Okay.
First question. I would like your feedback about secured party creditor status change.
Secured party credit what?
I would like your feedback about secured party creditor status change.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the term, so I don't know that I can make a comment on that. I don't know. Let's see. Brent, Brent, yeah, I see Brent is here. Maybe he may have a comment on that. I don't know. I don't have any knowledge of that. Brent, do you want to make a comment on that? Do you have any knowledge of that?
Secured party creditor change. I think that's what I heard said. Well, just to simply state, a secured party is a party that has a lien on something, or he's got a right to your property that secures his debt. In other words, if you don't pay, he gets to come in and he's got your property leaned up, and he can take it from you, just as a mechanic would have a lien on an automobile that he just worked on. He's got it in his garage and his building and his lot, and he doesn't have to give it up until you pay him. He's got an automatic lien on it. That's a secured debt. Well, if there's a secured party like that that has a secured position over a debt because of collateral, that's what the word is, that means the property that is put in its place to secure the debt. If there's a change of status, that means that he's no longer secured. And I mean, that's where I'd understand it, and I don't think that's far-fetched, but that'd be the simplicity of it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brent. Jen, any other questions?
Yes, next question. Have you heard of correct sentence structure, parse syntax grammar, with the postal court? That's the David Lynn Miller stuff.
Isn't that... I think we...
About a year ago.
Say that again? Who?
He died here a year or two ago, so I don't know who's doing
that
it.
That sounds a little familiar. I think it's something we looked into, the syntax, which is the bringing together certain words in a certain order, having some kind of a hidden meaning or something, or a conclusion or something. Is that what that's about?
Yeah, right.
We looked into that, and we didn't find much validity in it. We couldn't find a logical, you know, anything logical to really agree to on it. So, I don't know. Brent, are you familiar with that also? It almost sounds like a secret, you know, it's almost like, oh, goodness, what do they call that? Looking for the secret code in the Bible or something.
Am I unmuted, John?
You're unmuted, guys. Yeah. Yes.
Well, when you said the secret code of the Bible, I thought, well, this would make a good analogy. There was a book I read long ago. I was trying to remember the name of it, about the secret code of the Bible, and it's hogwash. Now, if you get sucked off into all the secret codes of the law, they've sucked you off. Just like this fellow that wrote this goofy book about the secret codes of the Bible and the Hebrew language, and he has charts, and all that is a Jewish Kabbalism. That's all it is. What is Jewish Kabbalism? Well, it's witchcraft. That's what it is. And if you get sucked off and siphoned off, maybe is a better way to say it, into their realm of arguing about secret codes and the law and all the... there's no end to it. And you're in an arena that wastes your time and their time. It's our duty as patriotic Americans to say, no, the Bible means what it says. And all this code baloney is not part of the revelation of God. And by analogy, the same thing is true with our Constitution of the United States, our legal documents. It's our duty to say, no, we're not going to understand the law according to some secret code that somebody believes some lawyer has devised, or a group of lawyers, or a bar association, or judges, or priests, or shaman, or whatever that we call them. God wants his truth, his laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature of God written in the Bible. He wants those to be clear to everybody. He doesn't hide the ball. That's all about Babylon, to hide the truth underneath. Oh, that's not what it's really meaning. What it really means is this. And that's why you have secret societies and the Babylonian mystery religions and Gnosticism and Jewish Kabbalism and on and on and on it goes. And only the priesthood understands, or whoever they are. I can't remember the name of that book, John, but I thought you almost said it. It was a book about the Bible, and it was a bestseller, and it caught hold, and people believed it, and it wasn't true at all. But it's easy to promote ideas like that, and it's a distraction away from the truth. It's our job to say, no, this is the truth. It means what it says, and it says what it means, and we're here to take the common sense of what it says, and we don't want to hide or to get caught up into that system that wants to make everything mysterious or appear mysterious. It isn't mysterious at all. Back to you, John.
Okay, well, amen. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the comments. Again, we did look into this very specific. There was an individual who seemed to be able to write in certain ways, and they were trying to teach us this, and I couldn't find any real common sense or couldn't find anything, any validity to it. And again, to me, it was just in opposition to a lot of other things. But anyway, what else you got, Jan?
Okay. I filed a bankruptcy at the end of March in New York State to stop the sale date scheduled for this week. Does the federal court notify the county court of the filing? I checked my file at the county clerk's office on Friday afternoon, and the bankruptcy was not there. Do I have to go down and file it with the county? My concern is that the referee will claim that they have not seen the paperwork and proceed with the sale illegally, which will only compound the situation.
Well, I did have a little experience with bankruptcy. It's been a long time since I looked into those things or was involved with putting together a bankruptcy. And, you know, a couple of things are very important. If you don't list and very specifically whatever it is, you know, the creditors that you owe particularly, if you don't list that in and you miss them, they can come get you. And they can get you after or during, you know. I don't know about, well, I guess during also. I don't know about that. But anyway, after the bankruptcy is complete, if you miss someone, you lose. You're going to have to pay that creditor. Now, I know that, you know, when you put this and file everything and you keep the papers, really you're responsible for maintaining a lot of the paperwork and notifying anybody that tries to collect. And I know there is a particular statement within the conclusion of the court for bankruptcy, as far as the law is concerned. You know that if they once they've been notified and the amount and what was owed to those individuals and the amount of that was owed to that individual. You only need to reserve the papers to these people to remind them, because it's against the law for them to come and try to collect a debt that was already covered and approved through a bankruptcy. So I know that it holds up. So anybody who's filed bankruptcy, they should have a copy of the bankruptcy and they should have a copy of the listings. And they can provide these people with a copy of that paperwork, and they are bound by law to back off. To either the conclusion or back off while the bankruptcy is in process. And if there is a problem with that, you can go talk to the judge that's running that bankruptcy. And again, there's a very special court that you go to for that bankruptcy. It's a bankruptcy court. But it's your responsibility to notify everyone and to make sure, you know, you can even file it in the county records there. And send a copy to anyone that is trying to, collect off something that has already been dispersed, you know, disposed of, or is in the process of being considered for disposal. But I don't know about them going out to make the notifications for you. Maybe Brent might know a little more about that. I don't. Brent, are you familiar with bankruptcy at all?
Oh, a little bit, but I'm not an expert on that particular subject. But I didn't understand the question. John, could you repeat it in such a way that would maybe I could catch on?
Sure. Jen, go ahead, repeat it, and then maybe I can give a little bit of a comment on the way it's being stated.
Okay. I filed a bankruptcy at the end of March in New York to stop a sale date scheduled for this week. There's a federal court.
And he's probably talking about a house sale, right?
I didn't say.
Probably probably talking about a foreclosure, which
yeah.
I never thought about that. That might be something to consider doing, but go ahead.
Does the federal court notify the county court of the filing? I checked my file in the county clerk's office on Friday afternoon, and the bankruptcy was not in there. Do I have to go down and file it with the county? My concern is that the referee will claim they will not have seen the paperwork and proceed with the sale illegally, which will only compound the situation.
Yeah, that's good. Well, it's good that they're thinking that way because, yeah, you've got to see to it that things are done right. If you have a concern, you're the movement. Make sure everybody's on notice, even if they don't.
Yeah, it's up to the person who filed for the bankruptcy
yeah.
to make sure that notification, and again, you know, it's up to them to go and file it with the county if that's what they want or need to do. And for sure, you know, whoever the settler is or whatever you call it in the sale, what did they call the person making the sale?
Didn't.
When you read that? In any event, the person that's trying to make the sale on behalf of the creditors, that they should be notified of that, and they have to back off. If they don't, you report it to the bankruptcy court. They'll deal with it.
Okay. Also, I want to file a federal suit against the bank and all parties involved. Can I buy an index number without submitting paperwork immediately, or must I file a notarized affidavit when I purchase the index number?
Well, you know, it depends on what is going on and what you're doing. I mean, you could start off without even going into the courts and do a notice and demand and see where that takes you. You can then bring that notice demand and do a show cause which is where you'd have to buy an index number at that point. You buy an index number and come in with all your paperwork and notifications, your notice and demand and the conclusion of that matter. And when they default on that, which they usually do because they just ignore the people, and there's a consequence for ignoring the people, especially the lawyers ignoring the people. They do that all the time because they figure, well, it's not in court, there's no index number, and they don't answer, but they should know better, you know. Silence when they have a duty to speak is fraud, period, end of subject. And they have a duty to speak when you go and directly do a notice and demand. So anyway, the best way to do it, and I've done it this way, is to do the notice and demand, go through the process of defaulting them, concluding the matter. They'll ignore it all, as long as you certify everything you're doing, making sure when you serve these people, you do it with an affidavit of service and do it all properly, just as if you were in court, and then go get your index number. Now, when you get your index number, and this is interesting. I know here in New York we pay for the index number separately from the RJI. And of course, if you're going to do a court of record, you don't want to do an RJI. You don't want no judicial intervention. So you go in and you get the index number. I think in New York the index number is $110 or $95, something like that. And then for the RJI, they want 210. So let me think about it. 210. Yeah, I think it's 95 and 210. What I usually do is I'll go do the $95, get the index number for the filing. And in this case, if you did a notice and demand, you then do a show cause why the court shouldn't see on your behalf because they've already defaulted. And now they have to respond to that. And you can see where it goes. But I never, or when I initiate a case, I never go to get the RJI. Usually, the other side will eventually do that because, the lawyers are there and they'll push that to get a judge into the mix and try to get things going. But again, if you are in a court of record, I would reject the RJI. I know I didn't do this before, but my thinking now is I'd reject the intervention by a judge. I'd object to anybody coming into the case that this is a common law case and pursue it. But again, if it's a contract thing, which generally usually these kind of things are, someone owes something to money or something to someone, and, if you think you can get justice, then why not? Go before an equity court and let them decide, because that can be done very quickly. Equity courts can be done quickly if you keep it simple. But, I don't know exactly, how they're pursuing or what exactly. What was it they were pursuing, did they say? What was the case about?
A federal suit is all they said.
Yeah.
Against the bank, reread it again,
because looking at it from the federal level, reread it again.
Also, I want to file a federal suit against the bank and all parties involved. Can I buy an index number without submitting paperwork immediately, or must I file an notarized affidavit when I purchase the index number?
Well, look, if you purchase the index number and then you use that in order to file your papers afterwards, so... but again, you can do a notice and demand beforehand. And again, if you're suing a bank, you definitely want to move this into a court of record, and which would be very difficult because they'll battle you out of this thing, and they'll push their way to prevent that from happening because the judges, pay much allegiance to the banks here, all the banksters. And so they like to maintain the status quo. But you got to try to prevent that from happening as best you can. Very difficult to sue a bank. It's like trying to sue government, suing a bank. But it can be done. I've done it, and it can be done. So, all right, anything else?
Yes, I have one more. This person just started the government by consent course. She was born in Illinois and lived up here in British Columbia with her husband and stepson for the last 4 years. We're moving back to the most constitutional place in the U.S. we can find. This week I've become aware of the new Illinois movement around which Representative Brad Holbrook of Shelbyville and colleagues are introducing H.R. 101. This will separate Illinois from Chicago. Representative Holbrook states that it is based on Article 4, Section 4 that guarantees a Republican form of government to the people. He stated in a speech that I saw on YouTube that there are six steps needed to create a new state. 1. Organize by county. 2. Declare independence. 3. Prepare grievances that are published and read aloud on the steps of every courthouse. 4. Constitutional conventions are convened. 5. Gain approval from the Illinois General Assembly. And 6. Gain approval from the U.S. Congress. Okay, so this person's very interested.
Well, it sounds like they're trying to create a state from within inside a state.
Yeah, or split off. They're trying to split Chicago out of the state.
Well, it's, the law is clear on that. You can't break a state up like that. There may be some. I know they tried to do that in California because it's such a big state, but that was in the beginning, trying to break that up into a couple of states instead of one. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to think where. Brent, I don't know if you're familiar with it. Isn't there not something in the law or the Constitution which prevents a state from being divided?
Well, no, the state can be divided. California has tried to do it, introduced legislation in the legislature within the last year. And of course, the state of Jefferson in Northern California, they've called it the state of Jefferson since after World War II. They've tried to do that. Illinois is trying to do it now, and it's serious business. It's been on Fox News. The Illinois legislature has carved out counties along the Wabash River next to Indiana, quite a few counties, and they said these counties want to join the state of Indiana. They're tired of Illinois or Chicago sucking blood out of them.
We have the same problem here in New York, too. You know, there's a lot of people want to separate New York City.
Yes, you've got New York. Texas has it now. Nevada has it now. California has it. Our whole country is divided, urban, rural. That's the whole political division. That's been that way since the beginning. It's just that up until even after World War II, more people lived in the countryside than lived in the cities, and that has shifted dramatically now, and we're struggling with the evil empire, the law of the city, as I like to say. But in Illinois, this is serious business. They've introduced legislation into the state house in Springfield, or introduced the idea they want a resolution. Now, if they can, they're signing a petition now. Petitions going around among the counties, Clark County, Coles County, which are along the close to the Wabash River there, and then down to Crawford County, and then over to Cumberland County, Shelbyville, all those counties. And the if they can get the signatures that they require to get it on the ballot, they can be put on the ballot. But then, according to the Constitution of the United States, Congress has to okay the arrangement. If Congress okays the arrangement, yes, it can be done. These are tough hurdles to get over, but I can understand why they want to do it. Of course, people know, I think it's been in the news, Chicago is just a hellish place these days. It has no money. It's raising taxes on people downstate. It produces nothing up there. It's racked with murder and crime like no place in the country. The fellow that runs the place is a citizen, I understand, of another country as well as the United States. He has his policies are clearly communistic. That's what we used to call them. You can call it other things now, collectivism. What it means is the banks run everything. That's all that means. And that's what they're at. That's the way it is in communist countries, too. And that's what they're after. So it can be done, but there are political hurdles. But people are mad. I've talked to people from around that part of the country. They're very upset. And they want to do it. And they've wanted to do it for many decades. But now it's coming to a head. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I got a novel idea how to deal with this problem. Why don't we, the people, just become educated and apply the law? The law is the law. You know, we have government not by the majority, but by the majority that participate. And if the majority that is participating is we, the people, are knowledgeable of the law of the land, and we apply that law and require the courts to obey and uphold that law, guess what? We won't have those problems. Now, it may be true that in a voting for the presidents, for instance, presidency, for instance, we may have a situation where the cities kind of take more control over, you know, the state than the rest of the state. I know New York State, last time I looked a while back, had 19 million people in it, and 9 million of those people were down in the city. So that was almost half the entire state is down in the city, and they're very liberal-minded and so on and so forth. But you know what? Once we get to the law and we educate the people, and get our children educated, it might take 20, 30 years for it to acclimate through all of the population to really get to the point of what the law is and how the law must be obeyed, and everybody agrees to that, because there can be, that's the only agreement we have to come to, that we have to have a law and we have to obey it. And it has to be laws that are constitutional. The Constitution in itself is the law, and it shows the application of that law. So if we became knowledgeable of the law, okay, required the courts to obey and uphold the law, require our elected officials to obey and uphold the law, guess what? We won't have any more problems. The political arguments are all a bunch of BS. Look, at political arguments, these people take a different position. Everybody's trying to fight to get the upper hand of the other, this view over that view and so on. Once people understand that the law rules, there's no need for political arguments and debates in that kind of a fashion. No one can get an upper hand above the other group, the opposing party of the idea or whatever it is that you're trying to push through. But if we can get rid of all of this funny money being given to all these people, which is nothing more than a payoff, in order for them to do the will of some special interest group, some corporation or whatever, okay, and get rid of all that, because it's illegal and it should be illegal. People should go to jail for taking that money, and they should be removed from office. Anybody taking that money and putting their vote in Congress on behalf of the special interest group, when they went there to represent the people, they lied, they broke their trust with the people, they're in bad behavior, and they need to be removed. And guess what? If the people understood and knew how, they can remove them in 90 days. We can remove any elected official in 90 days, through recall. And if we, the people, control the committee man process, which is the consent of government on the political side of things, then we can muster together in no time, pull the necessary signatures in days necessary in order to pull the recall and get it done. So it's pretty simple if we just go to the law. And then we don't have to worry about a particular area that's more highly populated that controls the position. And the only place they would continue to control that might be, of course, with the presidency, okay, the voting for the presidency. But again, if we have statesmen instead of politicians, okay, and we made sure that these people know the law, they understand the Constitution, they've taken a course, and we can quiz them on these things, and they know the answers, and they understand what bad behavior is, and if we watch them like hawks and remove them from office for bad behavior, if they are in bad behavior, then guess what? It doesn't matter who really gets elected, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. As a matter of fact, at some point, Republicans and Democrats would be irrelevant because parties would serve no purpose anymore. Because the purpose of parties is to divide and argue and try to get the upper hand above the other, to collect together in a position, maybe let's say pro-abortion or anti-abortion, and whoever gets that upper hand in the courts or in the political arena and gets the votes and so on and so forth are the ones that rule. And it shouldn't be that way. That's closer to a democracy, which is not what we are. We are a republic. We shouldn't be driven by majority rule. We should be driven by the law, because that's what a republic is. And we have the most unique republic ever, because we have a republic that is under the common law. We have a republic that separates the authority of the people, or the authority of the government over the people, where we do not have to be obedient to their laws. We only have to be obedient to the laws of nature's God. And if you're obedient there, you're not hurting anyone or breaking anyone's rules. So That's a much simpler, and that's what, you know, if we're successful in what we're doing here with National Liberty Alliance, and I do believe we will be successful, then we won't have to worry about that, and eventually parties will have to fall away. But anyway.
Okay. A couple other things. We haven't talked about it recently, but we are definitely still in need of grand jury administrators. We have only over, slightly over 1,000. We're looking for like 13,000 total. Also, we need some more help, more volunteers for the Welcome Committee. We could use 3 initially and more long-term. This would involve calling people. You would have training available. You would go through the foundational study to prepare you for being able to talk to people intelligently and finding out the things we need to know. And so don't worry about the fact that you're uninformed or you just signed up and you don't have a good background about NLA and what we're doing, because they're more than willing to train you to do these jobs. We need some more guest lecturers for the natural healing call. We're down to 2 more weeks. We have a lecturer signed up for, so if you or someone you know has a good knowledge, a working knowledge of some form of natural healing, it doesn't matter what form it is. It can be Reiki, it can be energy healing of other sorts, it can be homeopathy, even salves or other types of healings, and you'd like to give a talk. It doesn't have to be a long talk, probably 35 minutes minimum, and then we'd follow that with a question and answer period, and we limit it to 55 minutes so we can take the recording off before the next call-in starts, which is the Thursday night at 9 discussion call-in. So it's something that doesn't take a lot of preparation. Most people can get up, and if they're well-versed in a topic, they can talk for 25, 35, and even 45 minutes. So if you know someone or you would like to volunteer, just contact me. My phone number's on the web, on the NLA page. You can email me, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. And I would be happy to hear from you. And that's about all I had, John. So we're ready to move on. Are you there, John?
Yeah, I didn't unmute myself.
Oh, okay.
All right, yeah, we're going to move on in a minute. Just a reminder, everyone, we are gearing up for, you know, our action against the United States Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. We're still probably a good month or two away from filing because, again, we got to finish all these memorandums up. We are also writing the paper itself as we do the memorandums. And putting all that together. So, you know, we're still a little time off, maybe a month or two. But we depending on how we want to go about this, and we'd like to get a copy of the case to every single federal district court. And obviously it's going to cost quite a bit of money to do that. We may not be able to do that. I'd like to do that for the purpose of education and really opening the awareness to all of the federal judiciary by doing that. Our focus is going to be directly towards their boss, though, which would be the United States Supreme Court, who have a duty to make sure that they are, make sure that they uphold the fact that we are a republic, a republican form of government, and they have a duty to uphold the law, and they haven't been doing that. And one of the biggest crimes, one of the biggest problems, and you know, we'll chalk it off if they repent of it. We'll just chalk it off that of ignorance, because we're all ignorant. And the positions and understanding of different things, but they're far more educated than most other judges, and they go beyond what they learn in school because they're researchers and readers, so they should really know what's going on. And I find it hard to believe that the United States Supreme Court does not know that natural law courts have been concealed across America in every federal district, turns out in every state too, it seems. that it's almost near impossible to get into a court that is not violated by judges and isn't controlled by statutes dealing with civil instead of natural. And I cannot believe that they don't know it. They got to know it. And they need to fix it. Also, we have notified the court on numerous occasions with numerous papers concerning numerous problems over the past couple of years. And they have done nothing. They have lifted not one finger to fix any of the problems that we've made them aware of. We also made them, and they already know it, we've also made them aware of the fact that there is subversion going on by enemies, both foreign and domestic, with inside our own government. And we see now that Trump is working, of course, to clean that up, and there are many people working with them. But look at the United States Supreme Court needs to get on board. We've already notified them. We were obedient to the law, which the law requires that if we discover subversion, something that's going to injure the United States of America or we the people violate us, we are to report it to the president or some governor or some judge. Well, we've reported it to the United States Supreme Court, and they have done nothing. We've reported it also to the Justice Department, and they have done nothing. Okay. Well, now it's time for us to, hold their feet to the fire, make it clear. They have done nothing, and it's time now for them to do something. And again, the way we're going to do this and file this and the way we're going to position ourselves is going to be quite different than I think anything that's been done. But we have lots of precedences or, things in our law and in our past that gives us the authority to do so, particularly the Declaration of Independence. We the people, made it clear in the Declaration of Independence that we have the right to decide to dismantle this entire government and restart all over new again. Of course, that wouldn't make any sense. We have a perfectly good constitution. Maybe a few things we'd like to change in that, but it's okay. We could leave it there. We can correct it, and some of it we have corrected. The slave issue we've corrected in writing wasn't necessary, but to another degree it was necessary because we have it's a repentance, too. So it's on paper. But, but they played a game with that. That would be the 14th Amendment combined with the second 13th Amendment, which is the freedom of the slaves, and then the 14th Amendment, which they used the word civil rights. And again, it's a very dangerous word, in my opinion, to use the word civil rights, civil which identifies with statutes or statutory. It is true that our rights, there are 10 amendments that have been codified which deal with our rights. So with that in mind, the word is fine to some degree, but it also causes another problem with, their construction of law for the purpose of imprisoning the people, starting with the Organic Act of, 1871 or 73, I think, the Organic Act. And that construction of a city within a city or a nation within a city within a city. They do this because of a lot of distortment. We've heard people talking about where they're taught in school. I don't have my notes in front of me concerning that issue, but there was something that was taught in school in law, and I'm trying to think of what that was as far as the school is concerned. But in any event, one of the first points they were making, talking about the Constitution, it was a constitutional course given by the bar. And one of the points that they were making is that the Constitution is a contract. And we spoke about this a few weeks ago, I think, that the Constitution is a contract. And nothing could be further from the truth. If we go off that premise, we come to all kinds of different conclusions because now it becomes negotiable. And it also talks about that we've given up, they talk about us giving up rights in order to live socially together. I forget how that's worded. We're going to talk about that in the near future. It's going to be a subject matter at some point. But you know, where we have to, we kind of give up certain rights in order that we can come together in a social compact or something, or whatever they called it, or a pack. But nothing could be further from the truth. There was no federal government in place for the meeting of the minds for the purpose of a contract. You know, it is true that the states came together, okay, the people and the states, but the states came together in order to work out the Constitution, to work out the three branches of government, and then also, you know, working in the Bill of Rights to prevent abuse and so on. So they've come together, and I wouldn't call that a contract. They came together to put together a Constitution, which is not a contract. There was no meeting of the minds. There was no existing federal government that could say, well, okay, we'll agree with that, but we have to have this. Or we agree with that, but we have to have that. No, that didn't exist. No meeting of the minds. This is the Constitution is the law of the land. It itself tells you what it is. But you see, with the teaching going on, that it is a social contract of some kind. It is the meeting of the minds. And we have to give a little in order to get a little, which is a lie straight from hell, then, you know, again, this brings us right back to ignorance. We have this problem because we, the people, are ignorant. We do not know the law. We don't know our history. We don't understand the process and the procedures that we live under as far as the courts are concerned. We don't know these things. And it's not difficult. It is not difficult. And again, you don't have to learn to the point that you can articulate these things. You only have to learn to the point of understanding those things. And if you ever have to defend yourself, you can go back and refer to a place where you've learned these things. We're trying to put it all together in one place. We put it together in a course. We're putting it together in a book. One place where we'll be able to go in and look up different things that you know, but you may not remember enough to articulate, but you'll know, and you can find it quickly and then exercise it in whatever fashion you need to exercise it for whatever purposes you were looking it up for. But if we don't know the law, you may not be free. If you neglect to know the law, your children will not be free. We will not succeed at what we are trying to succeed at if we continue to remain ignorant. Ignorant may be bliss. Until the boot comes down, then it'll be really bliss. Anyway, what else do we have? That's pretty much it, Jan. I guess it is.
That's all that I had, yeah.
Okay. All right, let's move over to Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Okay.
We have a question that came through the email, and it was in response to a comment I had made last week, and I had said that, in passing, I said that the government likes corporations, and I said that if they can get people in corporations or get them involved with corporations, they can control the corporation and thereby control the activity of the people. And he asked if I would elaborate on that some, and don't know there's a lot to elaborate on except to say that corporations were promoted in America in a big way back beginning in the early 60s. And then up through the late 60s into the early 70s, and somehow it became popular for the smallest of businesses, mom-and-pop operations and farms, family farms, to incorporate. I remember when all these things happened. At the time I was a teenager, I didn't understand much of the difference. But looking back on it, I see that it did the government a lot of good, especially those folks that in the business of collecting taxes, made it easier in many ways. A corporation gives a lot of government control because it is a creature of the government. And the government produces corporations, gives them, breathes life into them. They pass legislation that allows it, and then the Secretary of State has to sign off on it. And what the reason corporations are popular is because they're promoted as limiting liability of the folks that invest in the corporation, the shareholders. Their liability is limited to the amount of money that they invest in the corporation. In other words, somebody sues the corporation is a person. The government says the corporation is a person. It can hold property, it can sue and be sued, et cetera. It doesn't have the right to remain silent or the right to speak, however. It's a person, though, for many purposes. And this person, of course, this person is no more than a corpse, not a person at all. It's a facade. It's something the government says is that isn't. I don't know that it's such a good idea. And there is some limited liability there. But it's my view that the limited liability that you can get establishing a corporation, which would include an LLC, an LLP, just a regular C corp or an S corp, that's pretty much all we have in America for corporations. You can get the same limit of liability and protection from lawsuit with a trust arrangement as you can by establishing a corporation if the trust arrangement is properly made and you avoid the whole idea of being a creature of the state. That's why we say, of course, it's downright foolish for a church to wrap a corporation around itself. Because all it does is give the government power over it. And that defeats a lot of freedom when that happens. Well, that's just a few words about corporations. If you want to know more about corporations, or know, I should say, what Brent says about corporations, that's yours truly, go to www.commonlawyer.com. Go to the media page. And there are two windows on the media page, and you can scroll down the MP3 clips in each one. I think there's 100 MP3 clips, audio clips, in each one of those windows. Total of 200, and in one of those, they're in alphabetical order. You can scroll down and find, I think it's 11 presentations, audio presentations by yours truly, on corporations, trying to begin at the beginning, explain what a corporation is, what it isn't, and finally ending with presentations about corporations that have to do with, as I'd said, churches and the inadvisability of incorporating the church. That's at commonlawyer.com on the media page, and there are buttons there. They're in alphabetical order under C, but I don't remember which of the two windows. There are two right there together. Well, we've been going through the Constitution of the United States, clause by clause, blow by blow. We're in Article 1, and we're up to about Section 8, Clause 17, I believe. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 says this: of the King of England, King George III, it says that they're mad at him, they're ticked, because he is exercising exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, I'm reading, over such district. I said that wrong. We've moved from the section where they're complaining against him to the section. I'm still got my head in the Declaration of 76. We're in the section that talks about the powers of Congress to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. This clause of our Constitution of the United States gives Congress exclusive and full legislative power not only over the District of Columbia, but also over all federal military property. And in common law circles, people that talk about constitutional law call this this reference to federal property, they call them federal enclaves. Enclave, that means a place carved out of a state. That's the idea. Because the federal government doesn't have any property except it could have property by the consent of one of the states, unless, of course, it has property, jurisdiction over property, such as a federal territory. And that includes, as we'd said here, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings for military purposes. In addition, it ensures to each state legislature the power to refuse consent to the general government's request to build military works and structures within the state's borders. However, once a state has of its own consent transferred such land title to the federal government, and that government has erected structures for military purposes, as long as that land is being used for military purposes, that state is without right to demand return of that land to the exclusive jurisdiction of that state's laws. I want to make a comment about another subject. My mind is wandering a little bit tonight, but if my mind wanders back to the question that was asked about a state representative in Illinois whose name was Hal Brook, I believe, from Shelbyville in Shelby County. And he joined up, or two other state legislators, the way I got the story, joined up with him, Chris Miller from Coles County. And I forget the other fellow's name, but he was from South Effingham County down at Louisville. And they put forth a resolution, the way the articles are reading, to make Chicago a separate state from the rest of the state of Illinois, which is understandable. But the way I got the whole story, there were certain counties carved out of the southeastern portion and the south-central portion of the state of Illinois that were willing to go to Indiana. Now, I don't know, and I didn't mention this a while ago, and it's a novel question, really. The last time this happened is when the counties that form West Virginia were separated from the state of Virginia just before the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states. And back at that time, it was true that counties had, they saw themselves, it was in the minds of Americans that counties had the power to do pretty much what they wanted. Government was much more local to the minds of Americans back in those days. It's hard for us to realize today that the only contact anybody had with government in those days was the county courthouse. I think I mentioned Conrad Hilton. He grew up out in New Mexico in the days of the frontier, and he made the comment once. He wrote a book called Be My Guest about all of his experiences building hotels all over the world. But I believe it was in that book he said that when he was growing up, not only did he not know who the president of the United States was, he didn't know anybody who even cared. Well, that's understandable because in those days, for one reason, the president of the United States, no matter what he did, didn't have any effect on people way out there in the on the edge of the world in the wilderness of New Mexico. But beyond that, the presidents in those days before World War I didn't have much power, and rightly so. They weren't supposed to have much power. Matter of fact, at that time, the Congress had a lot of power, and presidents were just to enforce law, and our economy and our country absolutely exploded in a good way, like no place on the faces of the planet had ever economically prospered before. And that was when we didn't have overwhelming law enforcement, overwhelming regulation, power of the executive branch and bureaucracies. And that's what, of course, Chicago is now doing and trying to milk the rest of the state. Let's go on to Section 8, Clause 18 of Article 1 of our Constitution. It says that Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or officer thereof. Now, this is known as the necessary and proper clause of our Constitution. Necessary and proper. It leaves it does leave an open-ended permission to Congress to do pretty near anything they want. This is the famous necessary and proper clause allowing Congress to deal with matters never mentioned in our Constitution, but which are nonetheless necessary to carry out the powers the Constitution enumerates. That was their point. Being necessary under this clause, however, never allows Congress open-ended power. This is what our courts have said, anyway. Thus, even though an act of Congress is necessary, government must carry out such an act in keeping with all of the Constitution's other demands and restraints under due process, which is the course of our common law. In all events, the words necessary and proper include no power to pass criminal statutes, take criminal jurisdiction over a matter, or otherwise seek a prescribed result. In sum, the words necessary and proper are not words of raw power, but words of administration of process. Let the chips fall where they may. And where the right process is followed, our Constitution ratifies the result. Now, that's some of the words of our Constitution of the United States, Article 1. I want to end by making mention of a subject that was mentioned a while ago. Has it slipped my mind? Maybe it has. It was about the jury and jury instructions. And some states have gone so far now as to requiring that potential jurors swear an oath saying they will follow the instructions of the judge. Now, that's going too far. I don't know that it's going too far for the judge to instruct the jury what he thinks is right. In other words, enlighten the jury about the case, encourage the jury, charge the jury, as we used to say, not really instruct, but charge the jury. But to tell a juror, you can't be a juror unless you take an oath to follow the instructions of the judge. That's going too far. It confuses people. Although, even in places where that oath is required, that doesn't bind the juror to follow the instructions of the judge if the juror in his heart of hearts feels that those instructions are unlawful. Why? Well, because we're going on the premise, as I like to say, the fundamental principle that no man has a right to do wrong. No man has a right to do wrong. Therefore, an oath to do something that you later discover is wrong, if you do that, you have a required to disregard your oath. You have a requirement to disregard your oath. The law demands it. And that's something we've forgotten. The Westminster Confession of the 17th century was when Parliament in England sent out the word, summoned the prominent clergymen of the country, Puritan clergymen, I might add, and Presbyterians from Scotland, Bible believers. Parliament was in control at that time, not the king. They had won a war against him. The Puritan party controlled Parliament. They summoned, in those days they were called divines, they summoned them to Westminster, and they gave them a list of questions. And they said, we don't want to pass legislation that runs afoul of the laws of nature's God, called the Bible. And so we want you to give us your studied opinion on the following matters to tell us what you believe the boundaries of our authority are under the laws of nature's God, the Bible. And the men there worked for a long time. And then they came up with one of the most telling and useful documents in our legal tradition, called the Westminster Confession later. Well, that document has a section in it about, I think the title of it is Unlawful oaths, O-A-T-H-S, unlawful oaths. What is an unlawful oath? Well, it's an oath, a swearing to commit an unlawful deed. Now, an unlawful oath may be unlawful, but when you took it, you didn't know it was unlawful. You thought that it was lawful. And I tell people that go for jury duty, you have every right to presume that the judge will instruct you properly about the law. You have a right to presume that. But that presumption may be destroyed after you sit and listen to the case for a while. It may be destroyed after you sit and deliberate after the trial for a while. And you may say to yourself, that judge is dead wrong. Well, at that point, and this is the point of the men at Westminster when they wrote that section called of lawful or unlawful oaths. Their point was that no man has a right to do wrong, and so an oath, a swearing to do something that's unlawful, once you discover it's unlawful, you have a duty to disregard your oath and your commitment to do that. So that's law. And by the way, that's what the Bible teaches. And that was one of the most important parts of the Westminster document, because in that day, monks and nuns would enter these institutions where they would take blood oaths of poverty and chastity. And, of course, the reformers said these are unlawful oaths. It's unlawful for a person to swear that he'll never get married or engage in sexual acts. That's just plain silly. And the Bible says, forbid not to marry. So to take an oath like that, you may think it was lawful because you didn't know the Bible, you didn't know the law of God. So you take an oath like that, but once you discover that it was unlawful, you have a duty to disregard it. It doesn't mean you have to go get married in that case. It just means you are not bound by it anymore. Because when people would try to leave those institutions in England and all over Europe, sometimes they were assassinated. And so this is a very hotly contested issue in those days, but it came down also to the principle to transfer it from that situation, to transfer it over to the unlawful oath of a juror. If a judge instructs you and you discover in your heart of hearts, and by the way, when you're a juror, it's down to you. You're it. You've got to decide. And you're the one that has the authority to decide right and wrong. Another comment about jurors that I think should be stressed, because jurors and the verdict of the jury is final, and I mean final in our common law tradition. Oh, there are juries in other countries that try to make people feel better, but there's a reviewing board or a viewing court above the jury that has to review the jury's verdict. That's not a common law jury, and that's not part of the common law tradition. If a jury's verdict is reviewable, then that's a violation of due process. That's a violation of the law of the land, our common law, and the verdict should be thrown out of the decision. Error should be left alone. The verdict of the jury should be left alone. The decision of a judge or a judges that would do that should be thrown out. But because juries, among men, we've been given the administration of government in this age. And the Bible tells us that too, by the way. This is the day, as Paul the Apostle says, this is the day of man. And that's in distinction to what the Bible calls throughout the prophets of the Old Testament and the book of Revelation, the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is the day of the Lord's administration of judgment and justice. The day of man, as Paul says, is the day when God has delegated that responsibility to us. So among us right now, we have this duty called judgment and justice and government. And the courts are part of that, and jury duty is a part of that. And if you're serving on a jury, you have to make the final decision, from which there is no meaningful appeal if the law is followed in our common law tradition. Now, anyone who has the power, the authority and the power to decide right from wrong in individual instances, from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal, historically and anciently, men have called such a person the equivalent, we use the word God, but they have called him, in the Older Testament, for instance, they call him El, or in the plural, Elohim. That means lawgiver. In the New Testament, Theos, that means, that's the Greek, Koine Greek word that's used, it means lawgiver. What is a lawgiver? Is a person or a combination of persons from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal in individual instances. That's the most powerful power that is available to any person in the universe. It's more powerful than raising people from the dead and raising up the crippled man to walk. Why do I say that? Because that's what Jesus Christ said. He said, which is the greater power? He said to the Pharisees of Babylonian Judaism. He said, which is the greater power? That I say to this crippled man, rise up and walk, or that your sins are forgiven? Well, they knew the answer. It was obvious. The question was rhetorical. Your sins are forgiven. But anybody who can take away the penalty of the law, that is power. Because you have suspended, as it were, that which will not change, the law of God. Well, God himself has the power to suspend it if he wishes. And sometimes he does that. But no one else has that authority, no one. Men have been given authority to heal men. Rise up and walk, said the apostle. In the book of Acts, and he rises up and walks. But no man has ever been delegated the power and ever will be according to the laws of God. To forgive sin, law-breaking. You can't forgive your own sin, and you can't forgive before God, and that's contrary to the claims of priesthoods all over the world, that they have the power to absolve sin. They don't. That's a lie from the pit of hell. God says, that's my business. That's my power. You talk about taking that kind of power, you're a usurper. You're an antichrist. And there are many people who have done that through the ages. But to get back to the point, the jury, and that's why the Bible says in the Older Testament, ye are gods, little g. The psalmist says that. Jesus Christ quotes that in the Newer Testament to speak of those folk that had the function of a juror. And the system of the Israelites was in five tiers of courts. One lower court, called the bench in the Greek tongue, the bench of idios, the bench of idiots, we would say, not in the sense we would use the word, but in the sense that they were exclusive to them, to themselves. And then there were four appellate courts above that. And Jesus Christ said of those jurors at that lowest level, at that trial level, at the village level, that was the powerful court, that, as it is in America. That's why, by the way, in the state of New York, where many listeners live that are on this call, They try to make that obvious. They call their trial court the Supreme Court. Most other states put the Supreme Court as the court of last resort. But they make the point, because down there where the jury is in the state of New York, and as in all of the other states, the jury is the Supreme Court. That's the court from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal if we follow our common law. And historically, such persons within the realm here among men on land, not up in heaven, but on land, God has given us that administration of justice of jurors. Those are gods, says Jesus Christ, quoting his father David from the Older Testament. Those are gods, little g, not the creator of heaven and earth, but they are, as the ancients would say, lawgivers, men who have authority to make decisions of right and wrong, from whose decision in individual instances there is no meaningful appeal. That's what a juror is. Very important job, ordained of God himself, the creator of heaven and earth, not to be taken lightly. And no one among mankind has authority to call the hands of the jurors. They make their decisions, and if God's law is followed, that's it. Back to you, John, or Gerard, or whoever's there. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it.
I forgot to add, John, that these comments are my own and may or may not be the opinions of other principals at National Liberty Alliance. But thanks again. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brent. Appreciate it. All right. Turn it over to Q&A. If anybody's got a question or a comment, star 6 to get into the queue, and I think they'll tell you to hit a 1. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue, questions or comments. While we're waiting for someone to get into the queue, just very quickly, you know, sticking with the subject matter we were looking at earlier, the difference between natural law and civil law, okay? let me do it a different way. Difference between natural liberty and civil liberty. Natural liberty is the power of acting as one thinks fit without any restraint or control, unless by the laws of nature. It is the right which nature gives to all mankind of disposing of their persons and property after the manner they judge most consistent with their happiness on conditions of their acting within the limits of the laws of nature, and so as not to interfere with an equal exercise of the same rights by other men. And so that is natural liberty. I believe I got both of those out of, I think I got one out of Black's Law and the other one maybe out of, I probably got it all out of Black's Law there. And there are some references to other writings from where that comes from. Now, civil liberty, okay, is the liberty of a member of society being a man's natural liberty so far restrained by human law, that's statutes and codes, and no further, as is necessary and expedient for the general advantage of the public. So, you know, we here in under our Constitution, the way we put our laws together and the way we wrote our Constitution and the Bill of Rights to secure that Constitution to prevent misconstruction or misapplication of the law. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. And that, you know, the Bill of Rights is the fruits of the works of the Anti-Federalist, where, you know, the Constitution in itself was the fruits of the labor of the Federalists. And of course, the Anti-Federalists were not necessarily against a federal government, of course, but they were for a limited federal government. They were very concerned about the federal government accumulating too much power like we see today. And we have to bring them back, which is the hard thing to do. And only the people can do this, by the way. Again, you know, Trump may be able to, you know, bring the law down to the point where he can take out the deep state and bring law and order to some degree to the nation, but it cannot be maintained. It'll never stay without the people consenting or not to its government and also understanding its liberties so that they can exercise those liberties. And again, you know, the problem, we need a large, well, let's say, we need a good percentage of the people that are the movers or shakers of things, the people that are involved, okay, to really come to an understanding of law, the understanding of what liberty is, the understanding of our Constitution and the history behind it. It requires, a majority or a good close to a majority, let's say, or at least half of the movers and the shakers in order to achieve that goal. You know, if a majority of the people, a majority of the movers or shakers, refuse to understand and come to a knowledge of the law, we can't have any of it. You know, I listen to Congress sometimes talk, and I listen to them question people and go through things and make all their statements and say all these things, and they have no understanding of the law, none whatsoever. They have no understanding of what our republic is, the restrictions, and how far they can go. They just go on and on and on and on. And guess what? That's because we the people are ignorant. We the people have not educated ourselves. And until that happens, we're going to continue to be destroyed by these people. You know, we have a lot of young people in Congress that are really, you know, way out there on the moon, Mars maybe, you know. I mean, they're way out there. They have no knowledge at all. You listen to the things they want to do and the things they say, and they have no clue that our Constitution denies that activity. but neither do the people. People let them go. They keep going on. People get more and more confused because we are perishing for lack of knowledge. Just as God said, my people perish for lack of knowledge. And that's what's happening to us. We are perishing for lack of knowledge. So, all right, let's take, we've got a couple of callers now, so let's take our first caller. It is Dan. You got the mic, Dan. Go right ahead.
I thought this was the most interesting call, I might say, and it's always something for all of us to learn. I have had some good conferences with a dear one of our helpers out of up in Charlotte, and we came to the opinion that we ought to bring this out tonight, and that is, if you can imagine all of the courthouses in 3,133 counties at least, that is just so monumental a representation of ad valorem taxes for one part, but fines and penalties for the greater part. And so this individual, a very precious lady that's been, I guess you'd say, tutoring me to some degree. I really like to think in them terms, and to give her credit. It comes to the attention that we should recommend to our group that we're not getting our fair share of ad valorem taxes by the way of what I'm trying to say. We need buildings that have to do with our ad valorem taxes along with others for the construction and building of a grand jury meeting place, hearing facility. And truly, I'm aware this lady's in training possibly to go in some of the district courts and be an overseer for common law, especially for jury trials. So not to get lengthy, there's probably some others that wants to speak. With that said, one of the sure things is in every county generally, there is a civic building, and a lot of cases is well constructed, and could serve as a purpose until our federal government would come into understanding that we need a building all for justice for the individuals to go there, have their case heard, and for a common law jury, of course, to not only write the law, but clearly determine the law and the outcome. One other little comment, and I'd like some of you, Mr. John, to especially you, to comment on this, and is I'm wondering, and I've gone in and looked at Mr. Brent, the website and so forth, and it mentions in there, this is the second part that I'd like a question, where there could be a common law lawyer. Well, I'm wondering about that, and do we have those, or either in some cases are known in law as next friend? I'd like a comment from that question maybe to go to Mr. Brent, and that's just a couple comments and questions that I have.
All right. Well, look at, you know, going into the courts as far as having a place for people to gather and to be the grand jury or take care of the business of the laws, of, you know, natural law. We need only go back to the Constitution and the authority we gave to Congress to create the courts. And so we vested one Supreme Court with the authority. We vested them with a jurisdiction. We also vested Congress with the authority and the power to create the tribunals. Okay, and that we'll find in Article 1, Section 8, the power and the authority for them to create the tribunals. Now, when they wrote, they said in each federal, in each district, there shall be one court. I got to go back and look at the language, but it clearly spoke about being a court of law or a court of record, both being the same thing, a court of law. And anything that's in law, at law, is common law. Anything that is equity is, done by code, statute, but in any event, mostly codes and statutes, okay? There are 93 districts or 94 districts. I don't remember. I think it was 94 districts. Maybe someone can correct me on that. But I believe there are 94 districts in the United States. So there are 94 federal courthouses. Each one of those districts might have two or three or more courts, different locations. Okay, but there are 94 federal district courts. Each one of them is to be a court of law, which first and foremost is natural law courts. Inside those same districts, we've given them the power and the authority to hear the equity cases. Equity cases are controlled and run particularly on the federal level under U.S. titles. On the state level, it'll be under whatever statutory processes they have in order to control, the bureaucrats, because that's what statutes and codes and regulations are written for, to control the people that work within the different agencies, government agencies, to control the bureaucrat, and to give them the authority to do this or prevent them with the authority to do that. Okay. Anyway, we've given them the power and the authority to do those things, but it does not control the people. And it has been clear. Look, at the courts have had 200 years plus, more than 200 years. They have been in control of the grand jury. Maybe in the beginning they wouldn't. As a matter of fact, in the beginning they wouldn't. It's a lot less than that. It's probably 100 years and less than 100 years, maybe even, that the courts have taken full control over the calling of the grand jury and the controlling of the trial juries. I mean, to some degree, of course, the judges, which should be magistrates in natural law courts, okay, they have been controlling some of the juries over the past 100 years. But again, as a study that we put together on a memorandum that we read earlier tonight, it is clear on how things should be and what the judges should be informing the juries, that they have the power and the authority of jury nullification, that they have the ability to decide both law and facts, and to deal with what the sentencing may be, which should have an eye on the focus of restitution. Okay, so all of this is already in place, but you can't find in any one of these 94 federal districts, you cannot find one place where you can gain access into a natural law court, a court of law. It has been concealed, and this has gone all the way down into the state level. Okay, so how do we fix this? This is the mission of National Liberty Alliance, is to fix this problem. This is the mission of the people through the common law grand juries. We came together as a unified United States common law grand jury for the sole purpose to deal with this subversion against the people, against the Constitution, against the United States of America by these tyrants in the courts. We need to put them back under the Constitution, back under the chains of the Constitution, bring them under the control of the people. And so that's what our lawsuit is about. And we're going to be approaching this in a very unique way, a very unique way. But it's going to take the people to step up behind this. It's going to take, we have over 7,300 members right now. But we got to wake up a lot of them that have fallen asleep. Clearly we don't have 7,300 members that come to our Monday night meetings, but they should, okay? We have a lot of people who have signed up for our courses and they're taking the time, and a lot of courses, they haven't gotten through it yet. But nowhere as many as we should have. We have about 1,000 people or 1,100 people, roughly speaking, who signed up to become administrators. Now, the administrators, which are the people that are really, they need to be trained. We have a real serious problem if people take up this job and don't get trained and don't get educated. You want to talk about tyranny? You want to talk about tyrants? We'll have them in every county of the nation, a small group of people who will be tyrants and a problem, Okay? And we need to educate these people. They need to become educated. They need to understand how things work. They need to understand the history. They need to understand natural law. They need to understand, you know, the validity of statutory courts, you know, the equity courts. And so first and foremost, they need to be educated. We provide that education. We're also trying to bring together, you know, to get enough people to cover all of these counties. We have 3,133 counties. We need four people for each county. So that's about 13,000 people we need. Let's say 15,000 on the very, very high end. But let's say 15,000, okay? We only have right now about 1,100. We have over 1,000. So we have we need over about 12,000 to 15,000. Now, these positions, of course, would be paid because people are being paid right now to do this job, to call the juries, to bring them through orientation and prepare them for the job. Okay, we the people can do it, and we should be doing it. We got to take it away from the fox because he has taken total control of the hen house. And they have not done a good job. Their history proves the fact that they cannot handle this job. Okay, they just cannot. Look where we're at. When we lay this case out, it's going to be amazing on how much liberty they have stolen from us, how much justice they have stolen from us. You know, people go into courts and it costs them thousands and thousands and maybe even $100,000, especially in the federal courts, just to get justice. And they don't even get justice. They don't even get justice, yet they have to have money. People are being destroyed and don't have the money to go into courts to deal with it. Look at this. There should be no charge to get into courts. On the statutory courts, yes, okay? But not on the not on the courts of law, okay? There should be no charge. You know, justice should be free. Okay, nobody is guaranteed that they need to have a lawyer to represent them, but they are guaranteed assistance of counsel. Okay, they have a right to get assistance of counsel. And if it's a criminal case and you can't afford it, it's the obligation of the state to support that assistance of counsel. Okay, you know, the prices of assistance of counsel is really way, way out of line, way out of line. And that, of course, is the Bar Association's fault. I mean, all the lawyers want to become millionaires, and you know, they're not happy with a good paycheck and a nice life with a comfortable life. Okay, they want to be millionaires. The amounts of money they charge for the things that they do, and I can think of cases I know right now. It's just ridiculous, the amount of money. But anyway, the point is that that we the people need to take control now. We should not be in some structure away from the courthouse. No, we should be inside the courthouse. You know, the grand jury and the preparations of the juries, both trial jury with petit jury and the grand jury, you know, should be brought through an orientation. But all of this should be done under the auspices of the court. That's not under the control of the court, but under the auspices of the court, at arm's length. Constantly on the run, never being reached, to be touched, to be grabbed, to be moved this way or that way. You know, just leave us alone. This is our business. This is the people's business. Stay out of our business. This is the attitude that people have got to have. And we need to do this in every single county. In every county, there is a state court. And in that state court should be a place prepared for we the people to be able to call our juries when it's needed. You know, we call the grand jury, we call the trial jury. We orientate them, make sure it's a good cross mix of, you know, the people as far as being peers to the people that are under, you know, that are in the system that's going to be judged by it. Once you set that up and you get four people in every county within four people in every county, so that would be for every state court. Well, those people will also be available for the federal court. But I can't think of much reasoning or any reasoning. And off the top of my head, I can't think of any reasoning. I'm sure there may be something where the federal court should be involved in criminal prosecutions Inside the government itself, they can come up pretty much, you know, and they may rise out of equity, but have to be, because it'd be criminal, they'd have to be judged in a court of law, not a court of equity. But it may rise out of equity. And so from that standpoint, yeah, they may have to call for a grand jury. Well, all they need to do is look at, grand jury needs to be pulled out of the county where the crime was committed. Okay, so all they have to do is call for the grand jury through that particular county, and the administrators of that county in that courthouse would handle the pulling together of a federal, grand jury if necessary, and also bring together the trial jury should it go to trial. But generally speaking, a lot of federal cases, they operate under USC 18, under the penal code, which is no law at all of the land. It's the law of the sea. Can't be applied towards the people. Might be positive law, but not to we the people. Can't be applied to us. Only to bureaucrats. Only to people who are working, employed, appointed, or elected into government. That's what that's for. Not for us. We would not be free. And we're not free. We are governed by local laws and ordinances, and we are governed by state laws and codes and federal and county and, you know, town and cities, and it goes on and on and on. You know, we're at jeopardy all the time of having to be pulled into these courts and just sucking the money out of us, whatever living we can try to meagerly get and hold on to, they take it away from us. And we live with it. And why? Why do we let them get away with it? How do they get away with it? They get away with it because we, the people, are ignorant. That's why. If we wasn't ignorant and we stood up for our rights and we told them where to go, they wouldn't get away with it. That's what we have to do. We have to take back control. And if we don't do it, and I do believe the strong likelihood that this administration out there in Washington is going to get behind us at some point. I do believe that. And I do believe that even the Attorney General will get behind us. Okay, we need to get the United States Supreme Court to understand the error of their way, make a repentance, and get behind we the people. And if not, we need to remove them. And if Congress doesn't have the backbone to do it, then we the people need to do it through by giving them an indictment. Okay, so we take control that way. We have to be under the auspices of the court. You can't have just any four people go in there and do the will of their minds. No, they have to do the will of the king of the court. They have to be under the law. They have to understand the law. And again, it's not. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to do this. You don't need 8 years of some college education to do this. No, this could be done in a matter of a month, 6 months. You could be highly educated if you put your time into it, highly, highly educated in this area. We've brought all the information and necessary knowledges needed together. You know, maybe we're missing something here or there. We'll get it by the end. And when we miss something, eventually we find it, we'll add it in. We'll get it in there. But again, it would be a derelict of duty. It would be a wrongdoing if people just collectively get together and start to wing this and try to run an operation like this to control the jury, get juries going together to orientate them or not orientate them, and not prepare the people for the duty at hand. They need to understand they're there to represent the king of the court, which is God, nature's God. We're under the law, the natural law. It's written in the hearts of all men. And this is what we have to exercise. We have to even consider mercy at the end of the day. We have to make sure we get restitution. You know, if people aren't aware of these things, how can they administrate for a grand jury? Nor can a grand jury come together and be forever. They cannot be. You know, I've heard of grand juries out in California. And they're almost, I guess they must be paid or something because they put a lot of time into this. But grand juries have been there for years, the same grand jury. We've dealt with problems, and I forget which states it was in, but we've dealt with problems where grand jury foremen have been foremen for 5, 6, 7 years. Well, what is going on? That's a wrongdoing. No, this has to be moved through the people, constantly changed and turned over to a different group of people. You know, even we through National Liberty Alliance, who have created the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, going out to every county and every state and collectively coming to an agreement and creating the grand juries within a common law grand jury within every state, and then collectively becoming what we are, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. Even we have a limitation of life here. We can't sit at this position forever. We're here for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to deal with the problems concerning subversion against the United States of America by enemies both, you know, domestic and foreign. And once we deal with that and that problem is solved and the power and the authority is given back to the people in the local end, then that has to be dismantled. That grand jury can't continue. But once you get control of the national level and you bring the United States Supreme Court back under the will and the authority of the people and the rest of the government under the consent and the authority of the people, once that happens, there should not be a necessity for a unified United States common law grand jury. You know, that came to be by using the things that they'd done, which we saw them do in New York. They unified all the courts. They brought them together and unified them. And that unification brought in the town courts, the village courts, the city courts, and they're all Nisi Prius courts. They don't even have real law, you know. They got regulations and what do they call ordinances and stuff that they apply upon the people. And then you got the motor vehicle law and all that other stuff that they exercise. Yet they unified them all. There's not a common law court to be found anywhere. At least not in New York State there isn't. At least not in any federal district there isn't. But that's what we have to do. But we must be under the auspices of the court. We must bring these judges back under the control. We need to make them leave the Bar Association. They've got to disconnect from them because they're the destroyers of the law. They're the worst. They're the ones trying to destroy the grand jury and the trial, you know, or even a trial jury. You know, I know my brother, when he went to school, he was being taught by some professor the idea that the people really aren't qualified to make judgments, that all these courts really should be done by professional, you know, jurists, meaning judges, okay? That we shouldn't have a jury. We should have judges making this decision, you know, political animals. That's what he's taught. Now, I don't know if they teach this in all schools, but that's what he was taught, you know? And he never learned, he heard about the Constitution, but never learned the Constitution. And that's the problem we have today. You know, you look up things on the Internet, and you explore things to see in this subject matter or that subject matter. In our case, we look at the law and the different things, you know, in that area. And you get conclusions. You get ideas. You get solutions that people have come up, but nobody ever brings up the meat. They very rarely give their sources where they get this information and the conclusions from or the arguments that were put together and seeing both sides in order you can see clearly what the right side might be. None of that. It's not happening. People don't even realize, and this is in every aspect. Look up anything on law and you'll get opinions. You never really get the sources and the facts because there are many things out there that are not moot. The Constitution of the United States, from beginning to end, is not moot. The Declaration of Independence and its true meaning is not moot. The Bill of Rights is not moot. Natural law is not moot. It is clear and self-evident. And so we don't have to be, you know, looking for something other than the truth and the facts and the conclusions that we already have. And again, each one of these memorandums that we're writing is clear and self-evident and absolute, and it's the debated. There is no debate over the issue. It is the facts and the way it is, and those are the issues that we need to deal with the United States Supreme Court and its federal judiciary, which it does not bring under the control and under the obedience to the Constitution. How is it that we can look at some of these different jurisdictions on the federal level and see how far socialist they have come, and Congress does nothing to get rid of these people? They can get rid of them. They can impeach them. That's what bad behavior requires impeachment. And if they don't impeach them and they're in bad behavior, they're breaking the law. And if they're breaking the law, we can indict them. So we'll get rid of them. But we can't do it until we get empowered. And we have to empower ourselves. We can't wait for someone to come and empower us for us. We have to empower ourselves and force ourselves upon the process and make sure that the people take control on a grassroots level. But we also have to be responsible and make sure they're educated in order to take control, in order to bring together these juries and give them good information and be an administrator to their duties. Anyway, if you remember the question, Brent, and you want to comment on it. Because I know, wasn't there something referred to Brent on that, Dan? What was that, the other thing?
Yes, sir. You want me to repeat?
Yeah, repeat, Brent. Give him the short version or whatever.
Just quickly, I had gone in and looked and was very impressed with inside of the website that apparently you've done a lot of work there. And we saw some evidence of where it mentioned, like, the common law lawyer, and I'm wondering if we have those kind of wonderful helpers, and are they different from what, or would they be the same thing as what we call our next friend that we could, you know, apply and have beside us in a courtroom?
No, the phrase common lawyer, and I use it in its older sense. If you go to Canada or England or Australia and you talk about a common lawyer, people often will know what you're talking about, but not in America. We're a common law country like those other countries. There are only just about a half a dozen, no, about five major countries in the world that are common law countries out of a couple hundred countries. We're in the minority. But in Canada, I've talked to lawyers from Canada, and they call themselves common lawyers. And historically, they were called commoners, for short, commoners. And in the rest of the world, lawyers or attorneys are called civil law lawyers, and they're the shortened version is civilian. The word civilian is meant foremost in the rest of the world to speak of a lawyer of the law of the city. A common lawyer or a commoner was in the way in the not too distant past that people referred to a lawyer of the law of the land. A lawyer is a person, the definition of the word, a person who gives attention to studying the law. It doesn't take a law license to study law, and there are many people that are, by that definition, lawyers. An attorney is a little different. The word attorney is an old Anglo-French word for agent. Attorneys in America, in all common law countries, are agents. They're retained and given a delegated scope of authority to do a certain job. And they have quite a bit of authority if the client delegates it to them. Depends upon how much the client delegates. You have authority to try this case. You have authority to try this case, but I'm not giving you authority to appeal this case. Or I'm giving you authority to put in place an estate plan for me, or to draw up a contract. I'll give you power of attorney. There's another word for agency. That's an authority, a scope of authority given. Well, that's what the word attorney means. Attorney is someone who has delegated a scope of authority to do a job. Lawyer stresses the idea that a person studies the law. We had a fellow at home that ran a sawmill. We called him, his name was Cornwell, and we called him a sawyer. That's what a sawyer does. He runs a sawmill. Well, that's what a lawyer does. He runs a law mill. In other words, the sawyer is there to make the saw cut the way he wants it to make the cuts and the boards he wants. And the lawyer's there to show you how the law cuts to protect you or help you do what you want to do. That's what a lawyer does. So there are only two kinds of lawyers in the world. There are commoners, common lawyers, and civilians or civil lawyers. lawyers of the law of the city and lawyers of the law of the land. Every lawyer in America, whether he understands it or not, is a common lawyer. Most of them, I'd say, never heard that term. I say every lawyer in America, with the exception of lawyers in Louisiana. Louisiana is the law of the city jurisdiction. And the lawyers down there are, in the words of the old world and of South America, the rest of the world, are civilians. The common law is not a common law jurisdiction, and Quebec in Canada is not a common law jurisdiction, both of them because of the Romanist French influence in those jurisdictions. So that's what a common lawyer, friend of the court, is different. Friend of the court is amicus curiae, the fancy word, and that friend of the court is somebody that files a brief in an appellate case to help support your point of view. Somebody who files a brief who doesn't have a dog in the fight. They just are interested in the case, interested in the issue, and they want to see it come out a certain way. Sometimes the court, the Supreme Court of the United States, will invite people, certain organizations or lawyers, to file amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs. Appellate courts, lower appellate courts, can do the same thing, but often they just say, well, no, we don't grant that permission to anybody filing a brief except the parties to this case. Anyway, that's the difference. There are only two kinds of lawyers in the world. There never have been any more than two, and there never will be, because there are only two traditions of religion, law, and government among men. There have never been more than two, and there never will be. We call one of them the law of the land, and the other one we call the law of the city. The law of the city comes under a hundred thousand labels of religion, law, and government. It's hard to sort out, but at bottom, it's all fundamentally the same. You have a Messiah, you have an Antichrist, it's an Antichrist other than the true Christ. You follow a lawgiver other than the true lawgiver. That's the false religion of the city. And then we have the law of the land, and lawyers of the law of the land are called common lawyers. That's pretty brief. I probably repeated myself several times. If you want to know more about that, and there's no way to describe it simply, I don't suppose, without keeping to flesh it out, you've got to keep at it. The book, Excellence of the Common Law, 958-page comparative law text comparing the law of the land and the law of the city, is available on Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, and that book will come up. Don't buy them. There are different prices on that book. I've been on there. I think the cheapest price I've seen has been around $70. I found it on there also for $1,500 in England. Now, I don't know how that happened, and I don't know who thinks they can get that kind of money out of it. But it's out there for a decent price. If you go to Amazon, you can find it. And it talks about these things. It talks about the difference between the law of the land and the law of the city, a common lawyer and a civil lawyer. In fact, there are several sections in that book on the history of the common lawyer, how he rose, and why there are lawyers in our common law country, and the necessity of them at the beginning. Are they still needed now, et cetera, those kinds of questions. Thanks for the question. I appreciate it.
Back to you, John. Dan, thank you.
Excuse me. Again, the name of that book.
Dan, just make it real quick, because it's after midnight, and we do have one of the callers. So go ahead.
The name of the book is Excellence of the Common Law. Excellence of the Common Law. Yeah. Thank you, Dan.
Sir, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Brent. Thanks, Dan. Okay, let's take our final caller. It's after midnight, so we're going to close down after this caller. It's Crystal. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Oh. Yeah, go right ahead, Crystal.
Hello?
Crystal, go ahead. We can hear you. Good. Can you get a little closer to your phone?
Okay. Oh, I was looking for my... Okay. How are you? I filed all the... Did you get that paper, last paper, Dan?
I didn't get the last paper, but I filed the paper anyway, and we just have to follow up. If I get it, I'll mail a copy to the court, and they'll have everything then. I can't see any reason or way that they can, not hear the case, And how did the courts take the paperwork when you dropped it to them?
They were nasty somewhat today. Some judges today, when I went to the court, and the people went there, they said, well, this judge, he's gone. He's resigned. He's retired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to me, but to some other people. What I did do, I did put in, like, a bankruptcy.
You know, that's an interesting way of going about it. And what's interesting about a bankruptcy, you know, you have, I'm trying to think what they call it, there's something you do when if it's a home you live in, there's a certain qualification you can get, and usually they do that, people do that when they buy a home, and they make a certain, I forget what it's called, but it prevents your home from being taken away from you in a bankruptcy.
Right, so I did that. I got
and that is an interesting way of dealing with this. I did not think of that. That's a great idea.
Okay.
And so anybody that is really tight on the dollars, and we all are in that case, and you're battling a problem with these people, go file bankruptcy. That's a good idea.
Right.
But I'd like to see how things go about. Are you doing it yourself, or are you getting a lawyer to go through the bankruptcy?
Well, see, I was supposed to have this attorney, but nobody will take my case at all.
Listen, bankruptcies, believe it or not, is really pretty simple. I've done one myself some years back, and it's a really simple process. I'll try to find the information that I had found, and if you follow their program and bring all the paperwork and collect, it's really all a matter of collecting the information and filing it in a certain format. And like any court case, mostly, and to some degree,
I'm going to get some help getting it done. Also,
I'm sorry, say that again.
I am going to get some help getting it done. I did file, you know, but you got 14 days and all that, and then the payment plan. But also, there is this other paper I got to get to you. I didn't have time to get it up because I was ripping and running from one court, doing this, doing that all day. And by the time I got home, I just literally collapsed. I was exhausted.
Uh-huh.
There is this paper.
Have you checked it to see if they didn't set something up for the bankers to prevent this kind of thing being held up into a bankruptcy?
No, I went to the bankruptcy, so it was accepted, but I just got to follow through. So I have to have everything done within the next 14 days. You know.
Okay. Well, don't waste a moment on that. Don't waste the last minute. So.
Also, I did file the police report because of the criminal activity.
Absolutely.
So I gotta go pick that up. I am just like at the wire time, you know, because I was supposed to pick up the police report today, but I'm also gonna file another police report tomorrow. If you go on, excuse me. If you go under the website under my docket, there's a paper, and it's very explosive, okay? And that's what everyone needs to definitely file. I can't even remember the name offhand, but it is on my – I will get that over to you tomorrow.
Yeah, get it to Jan. He'll get it to me. And
okay, I'll get it to Jan. Okay.
Look at
and
well, how did they respond? Well, now you served the papers to the judges, and you served that filing through the clerk. Is that how you filed it to the judges?
Yes, right.
Now,
well, because when we went to the court, I said, "Well, we have papers for you." She goes, "No, bring it to the clerk."
Okay, but now did they have any idea what those papers were?
Oh, they got it stamped.
Well, that's good, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do they have any idea? Now, this is very important now. Now it's part of the record. They cannot remove it from the record. And do the judges have any idea of the ramification of the papers that you filed?
I have no idea. They may not have at this point.
Did they push your date away, or you're still in jeopardy?
Yeah, I got another date for the 15th. Then they put me on there for the 29th of April.
You'll be in full swing by then.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what about the bankruptcy? Or did they get wind of your thinking and your position of the bankruptcy?
Well, they got that today, too. I mean, I was.
Did the judge have it before? You know, is the judge aware of it? Because if you went to the filing with the clerk and it didn't get over to the judge, you know, yet they may not be aware of it.
Oh, it's in there. It's in there.
Right.
Because as soon as I left the federal courthouse, I brought it to the superior courthouse. So it's all stopped. It's in the records. And also, I had to send it to those attorneys, the sheriff. No, we don't have a sheriff. Von Marshall, whom I've been trying to contact for the past, I put about 12 through. He's not picking up, responding. He leaves the post office box. So I said, wait a second. There has to be somebody over the marshal. So I found out the commission, the commissioner of the state marshal, who's over all the marshals for the state of Connecticut. So I got their number and their facts, and I put 3 faxes to them. I will also file it again. I will also put the calls through because, like they said, well, you have to contact the marshal, okay? And there's no fax number for him or nothing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, again, he's not answering his phone. So what I did fax it to the state commissioner in care of him, and I put his name and everything on there. You know what? I wonder if they have a badge number or whatever. I got to find that out, too.
Well, I was looking into my email while you were talking because earlier, at 4 o'clock, I went and mailed out the paperwork, or 4:30, and I didn't receive it yet. I just checked my mail, and I still haven't gotten it, so I didn't get the fax. Try to get a copy of that.
I'm going to go to the other place then. Because
okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, you can have it emailed or something.
Yeah, because it was at the courthouse. So maybe whatever I was sending from there, they were blocking because they do got that control. You know what I'm saying? I never made it up to the other place.
All right, well, if you get me that paper, then
I will
file the paper for you. Your filing with the federal court is complete. It appears that the filing. Remember now. You got to file a copy of the filing, you know, the affidavit of service. You have to file a copy of that also with the local court. Okay?
Yeah, that's filed.
A copy of the affidavit of service. You filed a copy of that in the court.
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, and I'll file, when I get it, I'll file it in the federal court for you.
Okay.
All right, well, it looks like things are looking a little better for you, a little up, and I think in the next week or so you should start to see some kind of fireworks going on with this because, I think we wrote a good, powerful paper, the first 4 pages. Everything else we had pre-written before anyway, and now that it's all filed correctly and they're not going to be able to reject it outright in any way.
Well, that paperwork, as they said, I got to get that other one to you. And I'm also going to go to the police department to pick up my police record. And I'm also going to file another police report against them, you know, because when they changed, they falsified the name, and when they deleted the 15 years of my recording records, they tampered with the records on the town. You can't do that.
Right.
It's just blatant criminal, and it's crazy what they've been doing to everyone. And but people are watching my case like you wouldn't believe. So, and I keep on telling everyone. We also different ones. I guess want to do an interview, so I just want to get all that stuff together. Okay, but I'll be in touch with you.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Okay. Good night.
Okay, we've come to the end of our program. We appreciate everyone coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next week. And again, remember, we all got to get going on education, every single one of us. If you've signed up and you're not moving through the courses, let's get moving. If you haven't signed up yet, let's get signed up and let's get educated. And also, let's get involved. We need as many people working with us as possible. We have to get the word out. The easiest way to get the word out is for people to find us places that, you know, that, you know, are filled with the Patriots. You know, they're all over YouTube and a lot of places, a lot of news, alternative news stations or YouTubes and websites. We need to get interviewed. Okay, National Liberty Alliance needs to get the message out of what we're doing with the grand jury and the trial jury and what's going on in the courts and law and so on. We need to get that message out. We need to grow. We need everyone. Everyone should look around to see if they can work something up to get just one interview for us. You know, if we can get 100 people getting us one interview, that's 100 interviews, and that'll give us a lot of exposure. So, everybody needs to do their share on this and get a hold of Jan in any way that you can volunteer an hour a day, an hour a week, an hour a month, whatever, you know, or more. If you're retired and you're looking for something to do, we got a lot of things to do here. Okay, thanks again. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for coming. Good night.